Welcome to a most improbable 110th episode of the Nerdstravaganza podcast, where each episode brings 110% the entertainment of the episode prior. I'm Tom.
I'm Eric.
And I'm Brian.
And today we can certainly back up our promise of 110% because we'll be welcoming as our guest none other than Dave Howell of Improbable Objects fame. But first, let's whet your appetites, dear audience, with our weekly geekly weekly update. Brian, you go first, sir. What have you been up to this week?
The new Star Wars ships are out, so I have been trying to get them. Apparently, there was a fire at a train station that prevented the FedEx from arriving on time, so my regular store, AGS, did not get them on time. He had one, so I got the Z95, which is I've been staring at it since I got it. I'm so excited about the new ships and about, you know, being able to play the game again, because it's been like a month since I played.
I have to wonder if there wasn't some weird karma thing because of all the train games the proprietor of AGS, Brian, mentioned on our last episode.
There's some weird karma thing about me getting Star Wars, because if you remember, the Imperial Aces like kept selling out, even though he very rarely sells quantities of Star Wars. I could not get up there in time to get them for, like, I think it was 3 weeks. So as much as I love AGS, it's not karmically viable for me to do a lot of my X-Wing shopping there.
The Force is not with you.
And the Steam sale, which I think people are generally kind of bored of this year. I've bought a couple of shooters and a couple of RPGs for, like, you know, 87 cents each.
I do believe I received a gift from you on Steam, and I appreciate that.
One-Way Heroics. That's a fun game.
Can't beat free. Thank you very much, sir. I will report back on it when I play it.
Oh, you're welcome.
Anything else?
That's about it.
All right, Eric, that brings it over to you, sir.
In my update last week, I mentioned that I got a new iPad, and it had been so long since I had one that was actually, like, relatively up to date, because mine was just this laggy, sluggish mess, that I had kind of forgotten all about, like, gaming on a tablet. So I got bored and decided to look into what was good for gaming on a tablet, and came across mostly games that were lousy. And then I came across a game that I played the first one of years ago and actually forgot about. And apparently a sequel had come out last year that I just completely looked over because I didn't have a device I wanted to play it on, which was The Room. And I went back and played the first one on the new device because I wanted to see how it looked on the new Retina screen, and then played right into the second one. And I know they're available for Android now as well. If you have an Android tablet or an iPad, and I think you can play it on iPhone and Android phones too, although I would imagine the experience wouldn't be as good. Those games are amazing. They're absolutely fantastic. They're a environmental puzzler, so like Myst comes to mind for that genre. Absolutely play them. They're phenomenal. They're a little bit short, but they're worth every minute of it.
I'll have to give it a go. I've been looking for an excuse to game on my tablet for some time, and Hearthstone is not out for Android, so maybe I'll give that a go.
Yeah, and I would recommend playing the first one, because I think you can get the first one for, like, 99 cents.
What else? Anything else?
That's about it for the most part. There's been a lot of sleep. I'm on summer vacation.
Well, that brings it over to me. I have been doing some more video gaming, still pretty Disney-oriented with the Disney Magical World on the 3DS and the Kingdom Hearts HD Remix on the PlayStation 3. I've been doing a bit of reading. I'm finally getting around to picking up my Nook again and doing reading. I think being out here in Seattle and unchanged from cable TV, that great mesmerizer, I do a lot more reading and listening to podcasts and things like that. So I'm reading a Disney-based book actually called Hollow World, which is all about a sort of a crime caper that takes place in the Disney parks. I will give you my opinions on that when I finish reading it. Wow, super Disney week for me this week. And on a completely different front, I mentioned last episode that I got my parts in from iFixit, my new trackpad for my MacBook Pro, and that repair went off without a hitch. It was super easy. Their instructions make it simple to do, and I now have a functional trackpad that doesn't go and click things on its own. So it takes away the sort of fun at having a ghost control my trackpad that I was experiencing, but I'll take functionality over that sort of entertainment any day. And I feel like a really cool tech guy because I fix my own stuff. And I've got my hands firmly planted on my hips, and I'm doing a kind of hero pose as I say that. But that pretty much wraps it up for me and our weekly updates. I think without further ado, we should get into the interview with our guest, Dave Howell. Let's kick it off. We are now pleased to welcome Dave Howell, the artistic engineer behind Improbable Objects and the maker of such Nerdstravaganza favorite products as the Ultimate Gamer Storage Bag and the ever-so-pretty and versatile Penny Gems. Welcome, sir.
Thank you.
Hi, Dave.
Hello.
Hi, Dave.
Hey.
Hi, Dave.
You too.
I get to say hi even though I did the intro, right? Right, so, yeah, anyway, to get things off on a personal note, Dave, I don't know if you remember, but I was one of the lucky few that had the pleasure of meeting you in person when I picked up my Ultimate Gamer Storage Bag last year, I think it was.
Yes. I still have a couple of Nerdstravaganza stickers to hand out, and I'm like, I met him somewhere. Where was that?
Like, yeah, I forced a huge stack of those on you, as I recall.
It was a while ago. I'm like, it was last year, so what the heck was it? Yeah, okay, thank you. That's right. The bags.
Yeah, that was a cool experience. And then I got to see, of course, you sort of meticulously organizing your huge shipment of bags that had made it in. That was an experience.
Yes. Yes, it was. Oh, my, there's a lot of boxes. There are 500 different kinds of bags.
I will get into the details of that particular product and the Kickstarter that backed it as we dig into the interview. I just wanted to get that personal note out of the way. That was cool. To be a ground zero for the deployment of bags.
Kind of that's why I sent the invitation out. It's like, hey, I know I find this kind of interesting. If you people do too, come pick your bag up and you can see in person kind of the behind the scenes part of how this sort of thing works. Because you go to the supermarket and you buy groceries and you think, how did this food get here? And, you know, a clothing store. How do they manage to get all these different clothes and get them out? There's all this kind of logistical maneuvering that it's kind of fun to peek at now and then.
Yeah. In the case of that particular product, I know, at least from the Kickstarter backers' point of view, that there was quite a lot of logistical maneuvering involved, and I can't wait to kind of get into that story with you in a minute. So.
Yes, okay.
But
yes, there was.
I guess we should probably kick things off in typical interview style by getting the background info on you that everybody wants to know. So we've read your online bio in a couple of locations, and you had some history at Wizards of the Coast initially. Is that correct?
Yes, I was actually employee number 7, but that doesn't really convey, because what happened was is that what most people do not realize is that when Magic the Gathering came out, WotC was actually 2 years old. That it had been a company. The reason that we got Magic was because we were already a company, and Richard and Mike were looking for someone to publish RoboRally. But the very first product, which I think it was 1991 when it came out, was the Primal Order role-playing supplement. And what had happened was is that Peter and his friends, they were a couple years ahead of me in age, but he'd married a woman who'd been one of my I was the game master, and they were the peons, whatever you call everyone who is the game master.
The PCs, yeah.
Yeah, so they were players. So his wife was in my play group, and when they decided to publish this role-playing supplement, as, you know, so many people have over the years done, oh, hey, why don't we publish this? It's really cool. They tapped another good friend of mine, who they knew was very smart and knew words, to edit it, and she started going through, and she's like, well, yes, there's a lot of grammatical things, but this book has bigger problems, and I'm really good at, like, making the English perfect, she said, but I'm not really the right person for making the ideas come into play. You should find someone else. And so they sent out chapters to other people they knew to kind of review and comment on, and I got one. They sent one to me because Beverly thought I would be good to look at it, being her former game master, and she knew that I knew something about words from the degree I was pursuing. I had a minor in publishing and printing arts at Pacific Lutheran to go with my major in music composition. Don't ask.
okay.
So I made comments in the first chapter and sent it back, and they're like, wow, you're the first person to get something back to us. Can you take another chapter? Because we got another one that wasn't assigned. So I did that one too and said, well, you know, here are the changes I'd make, but I think you've missed a whole idea here. You could actually kind of extend this in this way and sort of, you know, make the whole concept. It was planes, actually, and how they were going to handle different planes of existence better. And so then they go back going, that's pretty good. Would you consider maybe, like, rewriting the whole thing? Sure. Wow. So if you can get your hands on one of the now hard to acquire copies of The Primal Order, it says it's by Peter Atkinson and and there's three other names, and I am one of those three names, and then With, and there's three more people who'd contributed smaller things to it. So I was a co-author of product WOC0001, and continued to the fourth book in that series, Chessboards, was a whole book just about planes, and that was just, they just had me write the whole thing. So I have a single authorial credit to my name. You know, I'm in the database for one book that's having written it. But I'd been writing and then doing typesetting for them for a couple of years. And so when Magic the Gathering showed up, they're like, oh, this is much different than doing a book. There's color and cards and stuff involved. And in part because of my minor, it's like, Dave, you're probably the only person we know that knows anything about four-color printing. And I'm like, that's true. And so I was hanging out there and working on an hourly basis in the spring of 93 to get the first set of cards out, what is now known as Alpha. And then it all went off the printer, and I went back to being a part-time security guard and other things. And then they finally came in a month before Gen Con that year, 93. So, you know, July 93, the first shipment came in, and we all ran down there and opened up our first booth. I still have a deck that has cards from that very first pack I opened. And, you know, oh, it was very exciting. And Peter grabbed a bunch of them and, you know, jumped with a couple people in the car, and they drove down the coast doing demos, and then turned around to the bottom of California and came up at an angle through the middle of the country to end up in Milwaukee in time for Gen Con. And about halfway through his one-month trip, 2 weeks in, the one employee the company had at the time, officially, Lisa Stevens, turned to me and said, well, it seems pretty clear we're going to be doing this again. Things seem to be selling well enough that we're not going to go out of business. Hooray. So we probably should hire you as the production manager. I'm like, yay, a real job. So by the time we hit Gen Con, and I was part of the crew that went, I was officially an employee, but I'd actually been working for them for 2 years at that point, and then worked for them for the next 2 years. So that was really how I got into gaming. And while I was there, about 6 months later, because I was there at night, everyone else did their work on the computers during the day. We really had three. And then I used all three of them at night when I was doing color separation. So I would come in when everyone else went home, and I would work the night shift, and because I needed all the computers and most of the hard drives for the work I was doing. And I would answer questions on the mailing list. This was before Facebook. This was before the web. The World Wide Web had not yet come into existence. So it was like Usenet and a mailing list and stuff. And I would answer online questions for people who had questions about the game. And that eventually became, I was basically the voice, the online voice of the company. The title that I gave myself to handle that was Cyberspace Liaison. And doing that eventually kind of led me into trying to do a rewrite in the rules. It's like, yeah, people are still asking these questions, and they're not, so let me see if I can like clarify them. So I took a couple whacks at it, and I improved them, but they still weren't good. And I said, you know, I've done about as much as I can. We need someone else to get involved. I have a friend who's gotten kind of involved in Magic. He hasn't done a lot in gaming before, but let me see if I can get him involved. A guy named James Ernest, who went on eventually to do Cheap Ass Games. So I roped him into that, basically. I was the guy that got him started in the game industry. Before that, he'd been a juggler. So that's probably my most important accomplishment in the world of gaming is getting James involved.
I have to confess, and I hope Eric and Brian will agree with me, just hearing that background story, that I feel right now that I'm in the wrong line of, well, everything, frankly.
What?
That is, yeah, wow. I mean, what a background. I wish I had such stories to share.
Yeah, well, you get into gaming early, and you get lots of good stories. You don't get a lot of money, usually. There is the one notable exception, but yeah, there are better ways to make a living if you want to just make a living.
Well,
but it is fun. You know,
Tom, I was going to jump in on your comment because as a teacher, I totally get this. I have lots of great stories and absolutely no money, so it's perfect.
Well, here's the difference, though, Eric. The stories are there for Dave, but if he's got a set of those alpha cards, he also has gold, I think. Aren't those the ones that are worth like a bajillion dollars if you still have them?
Some of them, and a couple of years ago when things were quite dire, I ended up selling pretty much the whole lot off, which did get me a check for about $16,000.
Wow.
Not including proposal. But yeah, it was, you know, there go my signed Alpha Moxes. There goes my Time Twister. Yeah. There were some pretty fabulous cards in my binder, and now I have almost none of them left.
I should tell you that Brian is alleged to have somewhere buried in his castle a trove of early edition cards. Isn't that right, Brian?
I think that's looking more and more like my cousin. I had a kid who was like 7 or something like that, found my Yu-Gi-Oh cards. And I never really liked Yu-Gi-Oh, so he was like, can I have these cards? And I just said yes. And I think he took my Magic cards with that, because I can't find them anywhere, and I've been trying.
Bum out.
Who knows? But if it's stories you like, then I should probably relate the story of the proposal card, because that's a pretty dang good one, I must say myself.
Hit us, yeah.
And I have it on my personal website, but it doesn't get a lot of traffic. A lot of people don't find it there. So the alpha came out in August, or July and August for Gen Con, and we had the first expansion, Arabian Nights, out in December, I think. November, December, pretty early, because we were working on Antiquities, the second one, over Christmas. But after we'd done the work on Arabian and before they'd come out, Richard Garfield calls me with this, so is it possible to do like one card? I'm like, not economically. I mean, they're printing these things on these Heidelberg presses that are like 3 stories tall. You hit go, and in 3 seconds, you've made about 1,000 of them, and in 10 seconds, you've got 10,000 of them. I mean, they do 120 per piece of paper. So not really. Why? Well, he had this idea. He had this really rather romantic scheme of having a special card that when he played it, would be the power to ask for his girlfriend's hand in marriage. I'm like, oh, that's very sweet. Let me
see. That's great.
Yeah, so the card was called Proposal.
Wow, yeah.
And it said, I should go grab it. It said basically, when cast allows caster to ask for opponent's hand in marriage, if accepted, take both decks and shuffle them together and make one new deck out of it. And I'm like, oh, well, that's what you want. What I can do is, inkjet printers were still very new, and they were so new that you couldn't get one yourself. They cost about $30,000, but I said, I can have an Iris inkjet print made that will look very real, and I will have it printed on fairly thin paper, and I will glue it to a regular Magic card, and I will hand you that. I will basically, forge a Magic card for you using all the templates and originals. So I did that. I made him a set that's like, it cost as much to do 9 as it did to 1 because I had to do a whole sheet of paper, so 2 of them were screwed up. 7 of them are lined up properly. So here's 7, and if you really only want 1, you can just shred the rest. But this is what I got, and that's why I met him at the airport because he worked in Walla Walla at Whitman College at the time, and he was flying through Seattle on the way back to Pennsylvania where his girlfriend was. And so I met him at the airport and handed him the cards, and he put 1 in the deck. And the story he told me was that the first game he played, he didn't draw it. The second game he played, he lost before he had enough mana to cast it because it cost 4 white mana, and he was playing an all-white deck, and Lily was playing an all-black deck. And the third game, he had it, and he was trying to get the 4th mana out, but he was losing. And Lily said to him, well, we both know that there's nothing in white that will save you now, so do you want to just call this game and start a new one? He's like, no, I want to keep playing. And then managed to cast the card, prove her wrong, that there was, in fact, a card in white that would save the game for him. She just didn't know about it.
That would win her heart, not just the game.
That's right, and it was successful. They are unfortunately now divorced, but it was a great story at the time. Is one of the when I got to relay it to the mailing list, and I said, "Wow, that story's so sweet. I'm getting a cavity."
Wow. So I take it you didn't get around to developing the reconciliation card, which might have saved that marriage.
By the time they broke up, I was no longer at Wizards and hadn't. I wasn't seeing Richard as much, so I didn't really find out about it until kind of it had all changed. So, and he'd asked Lily who her favorite Magic artist was, and the answer was Quentin Hoover. So once it was all done, most of the versions of the card that I'd given Richard, one of them, of course, was still in that deck. The rest of them went to family members, but one of them went to the artist Quentin, and one of them went to me as the guy who'd come up with it. Quentin's card was subsequently stolen off a table when he was doing a signing in Japan.
No way.
Someone managed to steal it. I now know roughly where that card is. I've spoken to someone who's seen that card. But Quentin has since passed away, and Richard told me that they'd arranged for his card to be replaced. I don't know if they gave him a different one of the originals or if they made a copy for him, but he did get a new one to take the place of that one. And not surprisingly, I was eventually approached by a collector who really wanted that card. And the first time I was asked, I was like, I don't think so. I mean, it was a gift from Richard. But then after he and Lily were divorced and I ran into him again, I'm like, so I've got people that would are offering me a lot of money for that card. But I, you know, I wouldn't. And he's like, hey, it was a gift to you. You are welcome to do whatever you want to with it. And it eventually had less sentimental value. I'm like, yeah, well, I've had it and I made it and no one can ever change the fact I made it. So about a year ago, I sold it. And Lily and Richard had two kids. And they did custom cards for those guys, too. Now, those were sent – I mean, the birth announcement, I think that first one, they did like 1,000 of them. So a lot of people have Splendid Genesis, which was green, and Fraternal – I don't remember the full name of it, which was blue. Cost 4 green to cast and 4 blue to cast. And Richard gave me each of those because he said, well, you know, it would be a shame to break up the set. Then I'd be the only person that – you know, one of the few people that would actually have a full set of all three. So I ended up selling all three of them for $22,000.
Wow, that's quite a haul.
Good move.
It is. It is not the most that was ever paid for a Magic card. I'm told that someone scored a Alpha Black Lotus in Gem Plus Mint 10 condition or something crazy like that for like $30K. But it's still, yeah, five figures for some Magic cards was in and of itself kind of impressive.
Yeah, that's not a bad chunk of change. Good grief. That's impressive, man. So, okay, we've got quite a lot of your background to include that story. Did you say that story was chronicled on your personal site, by the way?
Yeah.
Okay, we will do our level best to drive traffic there per your...
there's no advertiser or anything. It's entirely, if someone wants to go, they're welcome to see it. There you go. Yeah, as a matter of fact, speaking of games, by far the most hit page on my personal site is the one where I have rules for Pinnacle.
Really?
Yeah, because as it turns out, if you type in Pinnacle rules in Google... my web page is like usually like the third or fourth one that comes up.
Now, I'm going to throw a really random question out there because I'm amazed that gets so many hits because my grandparents definitely did not know how to use the internet, uh-huh. And they were the only people I know that played Pinochle.
Oh, see? Now, the reason that I put the page up there was because my friends, you know, my age, my gamers that I would play in Seattle, they knew how to play Pinochle. We all know how to play Pinochle. Except when we started playing Pinochle, I'm like, oh, you think the royal marriage is worth 40? I thought it was worth 20. Or, oh, you have to bid the minimum bid's what? There were a couple of little tiny variations where they'd learned it one way and I'd learned it the other. And I'm like, tell you what, I'm going to write up exactly how I know how to play Pinochle, and then you can see it and go, oh, I play it this way. And we'll know before we start where we differ and we can take care of those problems rather than finding out halfway through a game that we think that it's done differently. So it was originally just so that we don't have to play by my rules, but if you read them, you'll know how they differ and we can figure out what rules we want to play with. That was why I threw them up there. And then, every couple of months I get a question from someone going, so we did this and what do we do now? And I'm like, this is what I would recommend. But one of the things that the page tells people is like, look, the first thing you need to understand is there are no official rules. Most copies of Hoyle's Rules of Games, if they have Pinochle at all, have a version of Pinochle that is nothing like what almost everybody I've ever met thinks Pinochle is. Like, yeah, those aren't Pinochle rules. What the heck? Where did they get those? Those are crazy. Yeah, it's really hard to find what most people consider to be modern Pinochle written up. There's a couple. And, of course, Wikipedia has rules for Pinochle. But what they have is the typical Wikipedia thing where everybody and their dog has come along and says, oh, but I play it this way. So the rules are basically everybody's rules all at once, which is not helpful if you're trying to figure out how to play the game. So I'm like, yeah, I just have one set of rules. And I think this is what really makes my rules better than everyone else's. I have explanations for, oh, here are some of the other variations that people use, and this is the reason that I think this is the right way to play. This is the game design value of this rule versus that rule and why you should, as opposed to just saying, play it this way. Blah, blah, blah.
I'm amazed because I can't imagine that anyone was like, you know, I want to know the rules to Pinochle, but I need it to be evidence-based. And the fact that you've taken it in that scientific approach is just amazing to me. Like, I don't know why I'm getting a kick out of it.
Well,
I want to look now.
In part, it's because... there was a book published a couple of years ago called The Kobold's Guide to Board Games. The Kobold Quarterly does these series of books, and usually it's about role-playing, but they did a board game book, which was edited by a friend of mine, Mike Selinker, and he asked a bunch of people to do essays for it, and he asked me to contribute an essay. And what I did was I adapted a presentation that I've given at a number of conventions, Game Storm, I think three different World Cons, a number of places because people keep hearing it and then they want me to do it there. It's called the Golden Guidelines to Game Design. And I basically go through and say, here are some very practical things you can do. If you've got a game that's kind of working but you want it to work better, check for these things. These are things that games do. And this happened because some years ago I was on a panel about game design at, I think it was the San Diego Worldcon. And someone said, what about game blah, blah, blah? And I just threw out, oh, well, see, the problem with that one is it violates one of my golden guidelines of game design. And everyone goes, oh, you have guidelines? What are they? And I'm like, wait. They were just like in my head. Get back. Give me a second. And so I started trying to figure out what they were and jotted them down while they, you know, talk amongst yourselves. I'll get back to you. And so I had 5 at the time. It's gotten to like 25 now. But it's basically a kind of a practical principle with some theory behind it. And, I mean, James Ernest uses one of my rules. He calls it Howell's Law, which is basically a game is only fun as long as a player believes they have some reasonable chance of winning. It's one of my axioms. So anyway, I've got this 1.5 hour, this 90-minute talk I do about game design. And so when I'm doing the Pinochle rules, I'm like, well, I have reasons for why I'm picking this rule, and why shouldn't I share them, as opposed to merely pontificating like so many people do. And then you're like, well, why is this person better than that person? I don't know. I'm like, well, I'm going to show you why else should you trust me? Who the heck am I? Who's this guy with his page of rules? You know, I'm not the Pagat site. I'm not Wikipedia official. I'm not Mr. Hoyle. I'm just some guy. So I'm like, well, you got no reason to trust me, so I'd better come up with some evidence to support this principle of mine.
Now, it's funny you said that you should feel like you have a chance of winning, because the only Pinochle story I even have is finding a deck of cards that was my grandmother's because we wanted to play poker.
Oh, no.
And you already know where this is going if you know
what
Pinochle
is. Well, I do, because
deck.
My friends did exactly the same thing, but go ahead.
So, yeah, needless to say, you know, when it comes time to show our cards, we all have a royal flush. And, you know, we obviously all felt like we were winning until we realized the actual issue at hand.
Wait a minute. I have the Ace of Hearts. How can you have the Ace of Hearts?
Right.
What's going on here? Yeah. Yeah, no, some friends of mine, before I met them, the gaming group I used to be with, they'd done the same thing. They'd accidentally picked a Pinochle deck to play poker with. And they're like, yeah, we figured out after a while that we were playing, you know, Pinochle.
Yeah. The winningest game ever.
Yeah, everyone bids really high, not realizing just how good the hands are going to be. I don't know. Someone should... I wonder if you could do that on purpose, how well it would work. Because family would often, because we played a lot of Pinochle when I was growing up, and we'd be like, oh, do we have a Pinochle deck? Oh, we can't find it. Okay, well, you take 2 regular decks and you strip out the 2 through 8, and it leaves you the 9 through king and ace, and then you have a Pinochle deck. So then eventually we got to the point, it's like, you have a Pinochle? Here's, oh, no, wait, this is what's left over. This is the anti-Pinochle deck. So we started, you know, we had a couple extra of those, because you lose the Pinochle deck, because that's the one you kept playing with, and the drawer would be full of these weird un-Pinochle decks with 54 cards in them. I eventually decided that what the world needed is a game you could play with an anti-Pinochle deck. So I did design a game. I call it Deep Six, that you play with an anti-Pinochle deck, because clearly there's a need. So I came up with something. I don't remember if I have the rules for Deep Six up on my website or not, though. I don't think I do.
We would happily link to those in our show notes. That's intriguing. And I like I was trying to think of names for it. So why Deep Six? I was thinking like some variation on Pinochle, like backwards or something.
Well, there's actually a poker game called Lowball, which is actually the idea is to get the worst hand you can get.
Yes, there is. And Hearts, of course, is based on not taking tricks. It's like points are bad, like golf. Points are bad.
Right.
So Deep Six, in some ways, did start out as kind of what's the opposite of Pinochle? So I think the most interesting thing, I'm not sure it's a great game, although it is, I like playing it because if you've played a lot of card games, and particularly played a lot of trick-taking card games, you're very used to like following suit and trumping, and I mean those mechanisms are useful in a lot of games. And they will lead you badly astray in Deep Six. Until you learn to ignore those reflexes, they'll screw you up. Because what happens in Deep Six is, okay, you do have to follow suit. If you can't follow suit, then you have to play something else. But normally you'd sluff. It's like, oh, yeah, this card is useless. You can't take anything with it. No. As soon as some other suit shows up, it now is bigger. And so at the very end of a hand, when, like, you know, one person's only got some spades and one person's got some clubs and one person's got hearts, the spades go down first, then the clubs show up, and now the clubs are winning, then the hearts show up and the hearts are winning. So, but you don't want to take tricks. Tricks are bad. So you're trying to avoid it, except that everything you'd normally sluff is worse than following suit. Unless you play what you might think of as the trump suit, but it's the opposite. It's a suit that no matter when you play it, can't take a trick. And so I call it the sunk suit, because it's below everything else. And because I have the sunk suit, that's why I eventually called the game Deep Six, because you're trying to sink below everyone else's trick and not take things.
And now it all becomes clear. Okay. Great.
Less obscure and mysterious. But yeah, there's some other things. I mean, you know, what are you doing? Because you have to take a trick if you can, and the sevens or eights. I mean, oh, the other unusual thing that I like, and I'm like, you know, maybe I should take these things and try and make a different game with them sometime and make a better one, which is most people who play Pinochle actually play the variant that's known as Racehorse, where once someone gets the bid, they name a suit, and then their partner passes them some cards. A lot of people do four. I recommend three. But you pass them some cards, hopefully cards that will help them improve their hand or make more meld, and then they lay them all down going, okay, here's how many points we have to start with, and now we just have to take the rest of my bid in order to not lose a bunch of points, etc. So Deep Six also has melding, but it has what I call invitational melding. The person names the sunk suit, and then they put down cards from their hand, including meld that they don't have. It's like, well, I've got three of the four cards for this, and I've got... So you lay down things with holes in them. Then your partner looks at it and figures out what they've got that they can fill your holes with. And so they'll pass you some cards. You fill the holes you've got, pick up whatever didn't get done, and now you've got complete meld. But it's invitational melding. You put down stuff that isn't quite there and hope your partner can fix it for you. So the advantage, of course, is that your partner then has a very good idea of what they should send you. Disadvantage is your opponents have seen most of your hand. They've got a very good idea of what you've got. And I've liked that. It's like, that's a neat thing. I should do something with that sometime.
Yeah, interesting. So, not a small amount of strategy involved.
Yeah, it's like I said, you know, it's like, oh, I don't want to lead this because leading is bad. I don't want to play high but if I play too low, oh, the trickiest thing, the thing that has really thrown me off is with hearts. Okay, you're trying not to take tricks. Great. So all you do is try not to take, and you know that means someone else has to take it. But Deep Six is a partnership game. And the problem is when you push a trick away from you, it's not unlikely what you're going to do is push it right into your partner's lap, and you still got it. Oops. So now you're trying to think, well, wait, should I try not to take this trick, or does that just mean we're getting it anyway, in which case I might as well throw something very takey on it now and try and get it out of my hand before the opponents make me take a trick I don't want to. So that's part of the – it's just got a whole bunch of things that are weird. I don't think in the end the play is so great that it would be able to take the place of Pinochle or Hearts or one of these real classics. It's probably better than Euchre or Pitch, things that people don't play very much. But I don't know. Because it's so weird, because it's kind of so backwards, it's like, you know, I'd really need to play it a lot before I could know and see how good I could get at it before I really knew if it was like a great game in the long run. And since I have to teach it to everyone I meet, I don't get to play it very much. So
it's you need to put the rules online so that people can familiarize themselves with it and it becomes a thing. And I wanted to say, so it's funny you mentioned Euchre and people not playing it very much.
Oh.
Brian, as Brian will recall.
You'd be amazed at the demand for Euchre in Fort Lauderdale.
Yeah.
There are clusters. There are little spots where people play. I mean, I've seen people play Pitch. I've seen people play Scat, which is a crazy complicated German game. I mean, every now and then I'll find somebody who knows the rules to some obscure. I'm like, wow. I've learned some games that I'd never heard of. There's this one couple on a cruise ship some years ago. They were playing what looked like, that looks sort of like Canasta, but there way too many cards. And well, it was called Hand and Foot, and it's like Canasta with two hands. You play through a whole hand of 11 cards, and then you pick up another hand that was dealt to you, and you have to play through that. And I'm like, okay, it's a lot like Canasta on steroids. Gah. Which is a lot like what they did with Pinochle for, you know, sometimes called Navy Pinochle or Military Pinochle, where you throw away the nines and you play with a double deck. And all the points are 10 times, whatever. It's, you know, it's like, yeah, it just kind of cranked up the volume on the game. So there's some games like that floating around, too. You never know.
No, you never do. And I think what Brian and I were kind of alluding to there is we have a game night. Basically, we do a at one of our favorite local game stores, we do X-Wing miniatures like every week. And that was getting a decent showing, but we wanted to sort of expand our audience because it's something we kind of do for our podcast. So we did every other week, we alternate X-Wing miniatures and kind of an open gaming night. And mm-hmm. we had what I've affectionately called a Euchre bomb set off in our play area where this lady came in, took over, and demanded that we play Euchre. Is that pretty much how it went, Brian?
Yeah, she was pretty militant for such an old lady.
Yeah.
Well, for such a hello, those are the ones. You gotta watch out for those old ladies. They're like, yeah, I've already done all this stuff. I know it. You're all kids. Get out of my... Yeah.
That was pretty much it, Dave. Like, I'm going to win. Let me explain how I'm going to win. And this is all I want to play. Like, okay, we're done. Yep. Oh, man. So, all right, we got a lot of gaming stuff. I've got a big takeaway in Howell's Law, which I will now use. My dad loves to go to casinos whenever he's in town and uh-huh. likes to take me with him. And I've taken one too many math classes to know that I'm just not going to win. And so I'm now going to invoke Howell's Law to let him know why gambling is not fun to me.
Well, and let me – it's very carefully worded. A game is only fun as long as a player believes they have a reasonable chance
exactly.
to win.
Exactly.
It doesn't. They don't actually have to have a chance to win. They just have to believe it. And it doesn't have to be a good chance. I mean, it's like, oh, you know, I'm five laps back, but there is a card in the deck that says Meteorite that would, like, blow it up. And there's a hope. There's this Hail Mary, cross your fingers, could happen hope. If someone still has that, they will still have fun playing the game. It's when it's like, even if they do have a good chance of winning the game, if they don't think they do, it's like, oh, I'm so screwed. You can never catch back this. The dice hate me. Then they're not having fun anymore. So they have to believe that there is a reasonable chance. And for different people, reasonable is a very different amount. But that's what takes them to still enjoy the process of playing the game. And if you lose it. So the essay that I did for the Kobolds Guides was basically stealing the fun. And it's, here are things you can do where people have been having fun and they get to the end of the game and then you do something in your game design and you've stolen that. You've destroyed their belief that they can win right at the end and now they're not having fun and that's what they'll remember. Don't do that. So it's basically the first six golden guidelines because that's the ones that fall under that Howell's Law, axiom number one, whatever you want to call it. Now, I do have the golden guidelines on my website. That is already up. Deep Six is not. I will get it up in the section on game rules that I have documented and made before this podcast is broadcast, probably.
Oh, really?
For people who are curious. Well, I mean, I have the rules all as a little PDF that I can print out and carry around with me. I've done that many times, so I'll just stick the PDF up. There you go. Hey, you can. So, I'll take all of 5 minutes.
You're happy to drive our millions of listeners to.
Yeah, I'm happy to indulge the curiosity of the one or two masochists who want to try and learn a crazy card game that involves a special deck just to see what it's like. And if they then send me mail going, your game sucks, or even, that was kind of interesting, and why did you do this? That would be awesome. To actually have someone send me email saying that I played your game would be so hilarious.
We'll take credit should that interaction occur.
It seems likely that I could not blame it on anybody or anything else.
Okay. So let's move into your actual products and really your use of Kickstarter. One thing we were curious about, let's just talk Kickstarter in particular at first.
Sure.
How effective do you think Kickstarter is in sort of facilitating that transition from, hey, I've got an idea to boom, here's a product? I mean, is it sort of a godsend for an independent developer of a product?
I will tell you this. I believe that it is not long before people will start to realize that the golden age of Kickstarter has ended. That there was a period of time when if you knew about Kickstarter and you'd get over there, bam, magic would happen. But that is no longer the case because too many people know about it now.
Hmm.
When I did my first Kickstarter for Penny Gems, which was 2 years ago about now? Yeah, it was 2 years ago. I had this product that nobody had ever heard of. Nobody knew who I was. And it's not for any particular game. It's a very, universal, Penny Gems are all-purpose kind of a thing. But as you have, you got, how many of you have actually seen and touched them?
I have. I left with a quantity of them, which I shared with my co-hosts, actually.
Okay. So then you guys know that the two characteristics of Penny Gems that are by far the most compelling are how they look and how they feel. there is no way to get how they feel to someone across the internet. And how they look is awfully difficult, too, because they're metallic and shiny. It's very difficult to photograph and then make still something that actually is mostly an effect of when you move and the reflection changes. And I mean, that shininess is seen because your eye recognizes how it changes as your head shifts and the position shifts. And that's lost unless you do a video online. And even then, it's really hard to light shiny things and take pictures of chrome. It's just very difficult. So it's hard to show what they look like, and it's impossible to show what they feel like. So the best qualities are not ones that you can easily convey through a web page. And the reason that the product exists in the first place, I'd had Penny Gems for like 4 years because I'd made them myself as tokens for playing cheap-ass games, which you need tokens for. And I'm like, one day I was working part-time at the company that makes these things, and I was like, hey, I could – if I had some nice like pennies or something, I could stick these, and then that would make a great counter. So the first ones I painted the pennies. I just took 6 coats of paint, and they looked pretty good. But oh my god, painting pennies multiple coats, both sides, flip, took, forget it. I'm like, yeah, that was too much work. So then I went to sticking them down, which you can't. The edge shows, which was kind of a bummer. It's like, oh, and you paint them, then they're the same color all the way around. But painting was just too much of a hassle. So I'd carry them around, I'd take them to game conventions and stuff, and I'd show them to people, and they'd be like, these are awesome! How come you don't sell them? And I'm like, because I've done the math, and by the time I've charged a distributor the absolute minimum I would need to not lose money on them, and then they mark them up their modest amount, and then the retailer has to charge something to not go out of business. I mean, no one's getting rich here. Everyone's doing kind of still, the final cost is, it would cost you this much for this many, and would you pay that? And they're like, probably not. I mean, it was like $5 to $7 for 10 of them. You need 40 to have a decent set to go, and yeah, now you're talking $60 worth of it or whatever. I was like, yeah, too much. So I'm like, yeah, it doesn't work. And then Kickstarter came along. I'm like, oh, hey, if I just sell them directly to the end user, then I can make enough that I'm not actually losing money, and they still don't cost an arm and a leg. I should try that. Okay, so here's this, you know, product no one's ever heard of. Throw it out there. I do. And I figured I would sell enough of them to, like, put some money in my pocket, and then I was going to go on and try and get a real job. Hoping I might – I think my minimum goal was – it was $3,500. It was going to be $5,000 at the last minute I knocked it down because I'm like, well, I can make a fairly small number of them, so I don't really need a big goal. If I'm lucky, I'll maybe make $10,000. That would be awesome. I made $22,000. Holy cow! I sold a lot of these things. I got a lot of work to do. Wow. Maybe there's more to this than I thought. Maybe there are more people who want these than I thought. And that became very clear. I mean, once I had them, and then I put the Etsy store up to sell them afterward, and I would take them to some game shows and meet people who'd seen them. I was like, man, the biggest problem I have is that the vast majority of gamers simply still have no idea they exist. But you know, and not every gamer wants them, but a significant enough percentage of gamers that see them want them that I'm like, if I could just get the word out, I could be selling a bunch of these for a long time to come. This might actually be a real business. So then there was a follow-up campaign with the auxiliary penny gems, and the problem with that was like, well, I need to get this out soon, but my family's going on this 2-week vacation where we're going to be on a boat in the San Juan Islands. That's not the best time to be trying to run a campaign, really, huh? Well, I can either try and do it really fast before, I'm not sure I'll be ready, wait until we're back, and then it's a long time before I'd get it done, or do it during, but do a short one. So I ended up doing it was only 2 weeks instead of the usual, you know, traditional 30 days. And, you know, it was a smaller amount, and I didn't put as much effort into it. And it still ended up doing, I think, $18,000. So I was like, wow, this is great. That was then. This is now. The third campaign I did was the bags, and we'll probably get back to that. And the fourth one I did was for the penny gems specifically for Magic. That campaign I had researched. I had talked to a lot of people. Like, man, I kept finding people online, and someone would go, hey, how do you keep track of your token creatures? Because I never have enough of those cards. Or someone goes, well, you know, what do you do for your plus? And someone would go, well, I use glass beads. And someone will go, well, I use dice. And it was very clear. I found these conversations on Reddit. I found them on, you know, Magic the Gathering chat sites. They were all over the place. And clearly, nobody loved their solution. It's like, well, I use this, and it works okay. But nobody loved their solution. And I had – I mean, one of the secondary products that I did for the second campaign was the Wound Penny Gems, because the initial set, the number one, the red one, it needed an icon with a single point because of my numbering system for the graphics. And so the shape I came up with was a droplet. And so here's this black droplet on a red background. Well, that kind of implies bleeding, that red. So I'm like, yeah, it's kind of like, hey, if you wanted to keep track of it. And then a friend of mine's like, oh, my gosh, these are so great for miniatures players because they're always stacking little piles next to their minis on the board, on their table, to keep track of attributes. So if they had penny gems they could stack up, that would – I bet you'd sell a bunch to them. I'm like, okay. So I did the wound counters, which have – they're reversed from the red. They're, you know, it's exactly the same except that instead of it being a black droplet on a red background, it's a red droplet on a black background. And then the other side is two droplets, so you can count to two, make little stacks, and, you know, and pile them. Like, okay, I'll do these for minis players. It didn't take long for me to figure out that I was selling at least as many of those to magic players as I was to minis players who were using them to keep track of damage. Okay. And then, of course, the regular penny gems were also really handy for tracking all the other stuff that in magic. You need a counter for this and a counter for that. And, well, they make really awesome counters for magic. So I was selling a fair number of penny gems to magic players. And I'm like, yeah, but the +1/+1 token, that's what we really need. The other thing that kind of prompted that was when I'd gotten a request after the first campaign for someone who said, so can you do custom ones? And the answer is, as has always been, well, yes, but probably not as few as you want, because the most of the work is designing the graphic that goes on it. That's what takes most of my time. And I'm like, yeah, I want to sell you at least 100 sheets. That is at least 8,000 penny gems worth of something. Do you want that many of these things? He's like, well, no. Could you do squirrels? Now, if he'd said saprolings or slivers, then I would have known what was going on. But he said squirrels. And I'm like, squirrels? Why do you want squirrels? And he comes back with, well, see, there's this game. It's called Magic the Gathering, and there are these things called token creatures. I'm like, stop right there. Oh, please. You do not need to explain to me about Magic the Gathering. You did not read my bio. Oh, token creatures. Yes. Alpha, the hive, generated wasps. Yes, token creatures. Old. I just didn't know that squirrels had become a token creature. That was news to me. I hadn't been keeping track. Oh, I see. Yeah. Yeah, token creatures. Yes, no, you don't have to explain anymore. But so I started looking into that, and at one point I had this plan for, okay, token creatures, jumbo gems, and they could be and they're actually tokens, and you could have a stack of them and stuff like that. And I looked into that, and it was like, yeah, but I need actual artwork. I need to get a hold of artists and have them do it, or find somebody. I just don't feel up to dealing with being an art director and managing that. I'm not sure I'd sell it. But the more I looked into it, I'm like, oh, you know, there's something else that Magic needs, and that's the +1/+1 token. There are 1,000 magic cards that say, put a +1/+1 token on blank. Wow. Yes, I've needed those. I've used glass beads and M&Ms and stuff for that. Geez, a plus. Why didn't I think of that years ago? So that was step A, +1/+1 tokens. Awesome. Step B was actually poison counters. A lot of people had actually asked me for something they could use as poison counters, which I'm like, okay, sure. And then step C was the token creature problem. And I was talking with a local player about these tokens. He's like, yeah, I mean, it'd be great if you could, like, I mean, I guess I could just put, like, take one of my magic cards and flip it over and then stack the, could you just make, like, a one that said, like, 1/1? I'm like, oh, yes. And so that became what I think is actually the most useful part of the Magical Penny Gem set, which is the absolute power toughness markers, which go 1/1, 2/2, 3/3, 4/4, 5/5, and 6/6, and the mana markers, ones that are coded, color-coded, red, black, white, green, blue, so that you can flip over your magic card or use one of my special metamorph cards, but whatever. You take a card, you flip it over, and you stick, like, a red mana counter on it and a 2/2, and you've now made a red 2/2 token creature. Look, you can see it's a red 2/2 token creature because it's got the things on it that tell you that. It's not just an upside-down card with a Post-it note that says, I'm a red 2/2, I'm a soldier. Or,
yes.
You know, and then you put dice on it to say it's 5 soldiers, and here's a die with 5, and then you give it +1/+1, and you've got to put a die on it that says, see, and it's got this other die that says it's 1. Now I did it, you know, you have a whole bunch of dice that you have to remember which one does. Ah, it's a awful system. Here, you don't have to guess. You can walk up to someone's table and look at it and go, oh, that's clearly a blue flying 2/2 creature with 2+1/+1 counters on it. I don't have to know what your secret scheme is. It's perfectly clear. I'm like, yes, and there are a lot of magic players. There are a lot of magic players. Man, I mean, I was on a trip, and I had to stop partway in a little town in the middle of Washington, and I'm staying overnight. I'm checking into the counter, and I can hear some people playing. It's like, oh, there's a family in the other room playing Apples to Apples. And I mentioned this, and the guy's like, yeah, I used to play games like that too, but I don't have much time. Well, what did you play? Magic the Gathering? Really? Let me show you what I'm my prototypes. And I ran back to the car and pulled out the prototypes. He's like, these are so awesome. I want them. I have a friend that needs them even more badly. And the next day, before I leave town, I stop. I'm eating at a diner, and the waiter comes by, and I have I had the Wonder Box prototype with me, which we may or may not get into because it's been postponed. And so he mentions that. It's like, oh, it's like, what's that for? Well, it's for storing a game. Oh, like what game? Like, you know, Seven Wonders. And he's like, oh, well, I used to play Magic the Gathering. I play Magic the Gathering. Of course you do. So if my waiter plays Magic the Gathering, I'm like, geez, they're everywhere. So I figured, okay, I'm going to do a campaign, Kickstarter campaign for Magic to get these Magic the Gathering tokens. There is a market. I mean, unlike the penny gems where you're replacing something that, the game already has counters. These are just better. So you don't need penny gems. They're just fun to have. Unless you're playing cheap-ass games. But for Magic, this was something that people already needed and didn't have. This was filling an actual need, which I'd never done before. Two, I had now a track record. I mean, people knew what penny gems were. There were hundreds of people out there that already play with them. Three, and they've got friends, and so they've been, I've got 600 people on my mailing list. I've got a whole bunch of people I can tell about now. I've got a PR mechanism that I did not have before. And of course, Kickstarter is more popular than it was. And I'm like, okay, so if I do a campaign now, my first campaign when nobody knew who I was and nobody knew what the product was and nobody really needed it, I had, 700 orders and sold over $20,000 of the penny gems. I ought to be able to do at least that well with the magical penny gems now that I've got so many people who already know about it, et cetera, et cetera. And, and if somebody like retweets it or posts on a blog somewhere or Gizmondo picks it up, I might see $50,000 to $80,000 worth of sales. I had 11.
Wow.
$11,000.
Wow. So here's where the golden age has apparently come to an abrupt end. What happened? Like,
to this day, I'm not entirely certain, but I'm like, what? How could I have done only half as well as my very first campaign when I had all these other things going for me? And here's the thing. Back then, all I had to – I would tell people, it's like, why did you do this Kickstarter thing? I'm like, because I'm standing in front of the fire hose that is gamers looking for something interesting and new. Well, so many people have discovered Kickstarter now, and so many people have gone, oh, this is a great way that I, obscure person X, who would never – who have, dreamed of shopping my game around to a publisher but didn't know how to do that and never tried, I can just do it myself. There are so many new things on Kickstarter. It is so flooded with people trying to sell their game, but it does not, quadrupled or quintupled or whatever the number of people who are trying to back games.
So
a bunch of people are now pitching, but we have not seen the same increase in the number of people backing. So now you're really fighting people for those backer dollars. And before, there was plenty of backers and not enough interesting projects. That's no longer the case. So now, if you want to do a Kickstarter project, and there was a game that a friend of mine did that I thought was – I played it. I loved it. I thought it was called Zeppeldrome. They almost funded. They missed – they needed like $25,000. They got $22,000 or something. I mean, they just missed it by a hair, which is very unusual. But there was another game that, about the same time that actually like funded two or three times over – it was about Chili Peppers, and I played that at Board Game Geek Kong too, and I liked it. It was a good game. I didn't like it quite as much as Zeppeldrome, but I would happily have paid for either one of them. But those guys were working with an established, small but established publisher, and they hit a lot of conventions, and they pushed Facebook. I mean, they basically did a huge amount of marketing before their campaign launched, and that is what you now have to do. You have to put a lot of time in. Instead of using Kickstarter to market the game, now you have to market your Kickstarter campaign. You have to put the time in and get the word out and get people involved. You have to have followers. You have to tweet. You have to whoop it up so that when you do launch the campaign, enough people notice it that it actually gets some traction.
Oh, my. So there's much more work that goes into it. And
doing a Kickstarter campaign now is at least three times as much work as it was when I started because of all the work you have to do before you launch to – publicize the launch. First time I did it, I didn't do any. I launched it, and then I told some friends. That was it. Now I'm like, yeah, I know. And then the whole time during the Magical Penny Gems, when I was telling people, hey, tell your friends. I was doing whatever I could to try and But I did it after that. I didn't realize, because the bag one had done fairly well too, and I had, since I'd only done the one bag one, I didn't know what to expect from it, and it exceeded my expectations, so I wasn't worried about it. So it wasn't until the magic one started that it's like, this isn't going the way I expected. Wow, there was a point at which, because I was looking for, I don't remember if it was 5 or 8, it might have been $5,000 for funding. I wasn't sure it was actually going to fund. There was this initial spike, and then it flattened out, and it was like, I actually went negative 2 days in a row, and I'm like, at this rate, it's not even going to fund. That's crazy. There was a point at which I basically tapped the Kickstarter tells me of the people who have backed how many other projects they've backed. So I looked at who are my top 10. One of the people who backed that project had backed 999 others. I was actually their 1,000th Kickstarter project. Where do they have the time to do that? That's crazy. They have backed 1,000 Kemp things? Oh, my gosh. But I sent email to those 10 people going, okay, I wasn't as organized as I should have been. And then people gave me feedback about it that made me realize that probably there were better ways to. So I've changed some things, and it's got a little confused and muddy, and it's also not doing very well. Should I cancel it and relaunch? Should I actually say, you know what, this is doing so poorly that I'm gonna see if I can try again because I think it should do better. And in the end, I decided not to do that. I decided, no, we'll just run this through. It's not going to do nearly as well as I thought. The real disappointment, the thing that I'd really hoped for, is if we could have gotten to ideally 30,000, but I was willing to kind of cover the difference, even 20,000, then I could have afforded to, instead of the way that penny gems are normally made, a roll of material goes into basically this monster inkjet printer that uses special inks that will stick to the vinyl, and it goes and prints it out, kind of, you know, the way things print. And then it has a little tiny knife on the print head, and so then it can go through and cut the circles. So it takes about 10 minutes to do 4 sheets of penny gems to print them. So, you know, it's a matter of hours and days to run a whole bunch of it and then be able to put the clear domes on. At a certain point, and it's actually a pretty significant point, but eventually, if I'm doing enough of the same, it would be cheaper and faster to have them printed by an offset press, where they could do 1,000 sheets in about 20 minutes.
I can tell. By the more aggressive sound in that technique, it definitely would be faster. That's right.
That's right. Yeah, you know, a press fires up and sheets just come flying out of it. And I talked to a printer in Seattle and found someone who I was all set up. It's like, okay, this is how I would do the sheet. It'd be like half of one, half the other, and they could do the die cut to make the circles, and then they would give me the sheets, and then I could dome them as I needed to. But the setup cost means that I have to do a lot of them. I need to do, like, I think it was 750 sheets before I could break even on it. And that meant I needed to hit at least a minimum $15,000 in sales, and we got 11. I'm like, man. And the campaign was set up so it's like, okay, if you pay like a dollar or two extra, then I'll put you on the early list, the people that I'll do first. And when I've filled all those orders, then I'll go back and I'll do the late list. If we can hit that 15,000, if we hit that stretch goal, then everyone's going to get them early because the printing will all be done in a single day, and all I have to do is dome. And that'll basically move a bunch of people's shipment up like 2 months. Even without incentive, we didn't get it. I'm like,
man,
I should have seen $50,000. I got 11, and I was pushing you people. Partly, I think it was that I was changing things partway through. You know, it was a more muddied campaign than it should have been. But I'm like, man, you know, even if I assume like double what I think would have happened for, you know, extra bonus demerits for being confused, extra sucky, you know, the video was worse than I thought. If, you know, if I try all the things and really I'm hard on myself, I still couldn't justify how badly the campaign did. Like, there's more than just me being bad. Something else was going on. And my best guess is that it's just that there are so many projects and not enough backers. So, yeah. So I think the golden age of Kickstarter is over. That now you're going to have to work your butt off to make Kickstarter work just like you'd have had to work your butt off any other way. I miss it. Oh, man. I miss just being able to go, hey, there's a project, and having things happen. That was sweet. And I'm glad I got to do it a couple of times, but I don't think it's going to happen again.
So, Brian, Eric, especially you, Brian, because I know you're our most prolific backer of Kickstarter campaigns, from the sort of backer side of things, do you concur? Is there just too much out there for you to back everything you might otherwise back?
There's a lot out there, and I have had to, you know, create a Kickstarter budget, and there are some things that I just had to pass on. But one of the things that I would say would make a huge difference is it is impossible to find any project on Kickstarter that you don't already know about. Their search is terrible.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have to agree with that. I'm kind of in the same place. I've backed a few things, not nearly as many as you, Brian, I don't think. However, when I look for something, and I'm looking for something specific, a few weeks ago I mentioned looking for bike lights. It was really difficult to find ones, just like you said, that I hadn't already seen. I kept seeing, every time I would try a search, the same three or four, until people started sending me links to ones I didn't know about.
But Kickstarter themselves do not provide an adequate search mechanism to seek things out.
No, and maybe there's no tagging or something. I'm not sure.
Kickstarter, to some degree, kind of deliberately does that. I mean, what you get is, I mean, there's, okay, you can pick a category. Well, but then you know, and then you just get, like, what's new chronologically in that category. You can get staff favorites, or you can get stuff that's popular. But I mean, basically, you're put at one end of a list, and you have to walk along in it. If what you want isn't super popular, picked by someone, or brand new as of 5 minutes ago, then you simply have to go keep flipping until you get to it, unless you know exactly the right search words to call it up out of the search. You know, and if they didn't name it the right, if they didn't name it what you're looking for, or they didn't use the right words in the right place, then you won't get it. And so someone has to send you there.
Another complaint I've, not me personally had, but I've heard about Kickstarter is they kind of don't care about the artists so much because they don't get their money from you. If someone doesn't find your product, they're just going to back something else. So the backers are giving them their money.
Well, I think it's tricky to ascribe intent to Kickstarter. I happened, it was very interesting. About a year and a half ago, I got an invitation from Kickstarter. It turns out they have this great little program where if one of their employees goes somewhere, and this particular employee, that because they're based somewhere in the East Coast, Delaware or something like that, Pennsylvania, but one of their employees had used to live in Seattle, and she was coming back on vacation, and so they had a budget. She could have a little cocktail party at a local bar, and Kickstarter would fund that, and then she could invite Kickstarter and have a little Kickstarter soiree, and the database would cough up avid backers, people who backed a lot of projects in the area, or people who'd created a project that had been a staff pick. And I was like, oh, really? That's because she'd asked me, it's like, so you're obviously you were a staff. I'm like, not that I know of. Well, it turned out that actually my second Kenny Jim campaign had been a staff pick at some point, but it happened kind of late in the campaign. And for whatever reason, it didn't create the bump that you normally when you get a staff pick, you know it, because that day all of a sudden, wham, there's this spike in your backing. But mine didn't get that spike, and so I didn't notice that I'd been a staff pick. So I had no idea. So that just by coincidence, I happened to get the invitation. But I went and I talked to some people, and I got to talk to her. And I was mentioning something. It's like, well, you know, one of the things is I'm not using Kickstarter the way most people do, and that I don't actually have a minimum. My minimum is so low, it's not kind of relevant. What I'm really doing is like pre-ordering and getting a better idea of how the campaign goes. And so I kind of worry that am I sort of perverting the intent of Kickstarter this way? She's like, no, we're totally cool with that. That's fine. But what became in part clear by talking to her and in part by listening to some of the interviews that have been done with the founders, they really aren't focused on how much money are we going to make today. You know, the fact that Indiegogo has a different funding model and there's other kinds of products that they've delivered, you know, their thing about not doing genetically modified anymore, they have lots of rules and things, and these rules often don't improve their bottom line. Because that's fine. They're obviously, you know, they're making way the heck more money than they ever expected to, and they're not out to get rich. They're out to be this kind of alternative arts mechanism. What they really care about is making cool things happen more than making people rich. So anytime I see someone going, oh, Kickstarter's doing blank because it makes them more money, I'm like, yeah, I don't think so. They're doing it for some other reason, probably. That, you know, the bottom, they're making plenty of money now. They do not have to worry about maximizing their financial return. So when you look at what's going on and why do they do something, I am usually suspicious of justification that involves profit. Because they have demonstrated on more than one occasion that is not their primary goal.
Well, that's good to hear.
Or so I think.
Yeah, I agree with Brian. That is good to hear. I'm glad that their mission is more important than the profiting or profiteering or whatever you want to call it.
Revenue, bottom line. Yeah. I mean, yeah, they don't ignore it. I mean, I think they do pay attention to some things, but to me, their behavior is at least as much about facilitating artistic expression as it is about ka-ching. So,
okay. Yeah. A better way for me to put it was, it's encouraging to hear that the good guy, I support artists side of them has as much weight as the evil businessman side.
Hey, businessmen are not evil.
You are not evil. You are not an evil businessman, but we know that some evil businessmen exist in the wide.
That is true. Well, then there are evil arts funders too, who will sell you snake oil and run away. There are suspicious characters doing things for bad reasons all over the place. But yeah, but it is nice to know that they do not have the single priority and the one that is already well represented by plenty of other people. Like, thanks for adding some diversity to the business world by you know, and the smaller a company is, the easier it is for them to have other priorities besides money. I mean, that's one of the things that I kind of feel bad sideline for big businesses is by the time you get to be 3M, IBM, General Electric, Microsoft, whatever, that huge, at that point, it becomes extremely difficult to be anything other than driven by finances because you are now owned by millions of people.
Right.
And the vast majority of those shareholders, what they care about is the bottom line. And the laws in this country are if you don't take care of the bottom line well enough as a board of directors member or a CEO, you can get sued. You can be taken to court for not being a responsible business person by not paying attention to how much money you make. So,
correct, yes.
They're legally driven to have to pay attention to money. So I'm like, yeah, with an environment like that, it's very difficult to be able to sneak into your quarter, you know, your annual report, and here's what we're doing for the environment, unless you can go, and it makes us money too. Because anything other than it makes us money sets you up for a lawsuit. The bigger a company is, the less latitude they have. There are companies, I mean, 3M and Target are two companies I know that are huge and still manage to have more going on than just we're making money. 3M has this awesome program for their engineers where they get to take time off and just do whatever they want to. Kind of like what Google does, but 3M was doing it first and they're not Google. Yeah, you know, like, no one knows that, but they're cool too. So there are companies that still manage to be more than just money, money, money. But there's a force driving companies that way, and the bigger the company is, the harder it is to resist that force. So it's little companies where it's like, I'm the whole thing. I'm the boss. I can do whatever I damn well want to, and if what I'm doing doesn't make us money, fine. It makes me happy. It's very easy for a little company to do that, but when you got shareholders, it's a lot harder. So
Right. Enough people look at the little bar chart on their 401k and see a slice shrinking, and then they make a call and several calls happen. Next thing you know, you failed in your fiduciary responsibility to your shareholders. And
so when someone complains about, you know, a great big company being like, it's like an amoeba. You don't blame an amoeba for eating the paramecium. That's what it does. Great big companies are driven by these forces, and it's not, no one's being evil there on purpose. It's being evil because that's the environment it's in. And you just, yeah, you make government laws that tell them that you can't do that, and we can sue you if you do. That's, but you don't get upset about it.
Thank you. Now that, wow, I didn't think we'd get on this point, but that is a point, and I was joking earlier with my characterization of like the evil businessman, but I make that point in arguments with my friends and colleagues all the time. The corporation isn't necessarily evil, it's just a lion. And so, you know, as a zookeeper, you have to maintain the lion in the zoo. You don't hand the lion the keys to the zoo, right?
Yeah.
That's kind of the trick.
Yeah, see, I don't even use a mammal. Like, a mammal still gives you too much latitude for it being able to think. No, we're talking, you know, mollusk, you're talking, you know, shark.
I like a beaver.
There's a lot less intellect by the time you're at a corporate level. There's very little room for thinking, that kind of a thing. Yeah, so, but it's, you still hope that occasionally there are people up the upper levels that understand that there are times when not going for the best cash thing is actually the best thing for the company in the long run. I have surprised some of my customers, like a while back, there was a shipment to Canada, and when they got it, it's like, it has only two sheets in it, not the 16 I was expecting. And I'm like, really? it was clear from the email that they at least partially suspected that I simply hadn't sent them everything I was supposed to. And I'm like, man, I remember packing that box and it was full. I suspect what happened was the box burst open in transit and then someone found some of it and stuffed it back in and taped it back up again, but they didn't realize they'd already lost a bunch of it. And so like a bunch of it, but anyway, but I'm like, well, okay, I'll send you a new one. Like most companies, it's like, I am not responsible for what happens during shipping, but my way of thinking is I'm in this for the long, I'm looking at the long game. If something goes wrong and I can fix it easily, I will have impressed that person. And then they will then go, wow, I like this company. I will order more stuff from them. I will tell my friends. I will, you know, it doesn't cost me nearly as much right now as it would in the long run in sales I might have made if I'm just like not making this person happy. So it's very easy to get me to send out replacements for things. It's like, oh, you never got it. I don't know what happened. Well, I'll just send you a new one. I'm looking at the long view, and I'm like, just, you know, not even argue. It's like, you know, I've had people like, do you need me to send you pictures of my defective penny gems? I'm like, no, I do not need pictures. I know that there are defective penny gems. I try not to let them go out, but sometimes they do. Just tell me what you need.
That's a great way to handle customer relations, I think, and it's good for
you. It is. I mean, it saves me time versus, oh, no, I need to see this or send them back or something like that. And the extra cost in product that is trivial compared to the goodwill that I'm getting. So I'm like, yeah, play the long game. Be nice because nice pays as long as you're not like, you know, picking up and moving to the next town. It's not like the Music Man where I'm going to a new gullible town and selling stuff and running. Yes. It's like, no, I want – it's much more fun to have long-term customers, people who know you and want to find you and talk to you. And you know, it's like, that's fun. That's part of the fun. I want that. So I'm going to do – everything I can to keep customers happy. That I've known for a long time is that, you know, some businesses, Walmart, for example, is competing on price. They're trying to, you know, offer a nice experience, but really it's all about the lowest common denominator. And that's very cutthroat. When you're fighting people on price, there's no customer loyalty. It's whoever's cheapest today. It is so much nicer to be at the other end of the spectrum, to be doing Beverly Hills type sales, be doing, you know, selling Lexuses than you know, Toyotas. Because those customers, you get to spend more time with them. You can retain them better. You can treat them better because you've got more. It's much more fun to sell a luxury product. And so entirely by accident, when I did the penny gems, I'm like, oh, hey, this is a high-end product. This is something I have to charge a lot of money for, but it's really good. Yay! I'm selling something I can be proud of, something that I don't ever have to cut corners on. It's like, no, I'm not the cheapest. I'm the best. That's more fun to do. It's more fun to represent a product like that. So that's definitely been part of what's kept me doing this, even though I'm still not really selling as many as I need to. It's like, yeah, but it's fun to represent a product that is awesome.
Well, you definitely do, and I think it's no accident that we wanted to have you on our show. Brian and I are both satisfied owners of the Ultimate Gamers storage bag, and I wanted to next ask you about that. And I, before asking you about actually what went down, I wanted to highlight for our listeners your excellent customer service and ability to cope with incidents that arise. I'm referring, of course, to the great goat hide fiasco of 2013. That's what we've called it.
Months and months, yes. Where are my bags?
Love to hear your take on that, on what happened geopolitically with these goat hides and the sourcing of materials, and how well your customers took it. I know you were giving regular updates. You were handling it. Did you have, you know, people with torches and pitchforks, or did people more
my
or less
handle it? Customers were awesome. I had one person who asked, basically said, I want my money back. It's taken too long. And what had happened in this case, he was in Japan or somewhere. I mean, foreign sales. And he and some other friends had gone together to get these things. And it took so long that by the time I still hadn't gotten the bags. And he's like, yeah, we don't play that game anymore. And they've moved. And, you know, like, I'm like, you totally, yeah. I mean, you didn't have to tell me, but that extra, yeah, you totally, here's your money back.
What was the underlying cause? In our mythology, there was like a civil war between two sort of goat-based cities, and that delayed the goat hide shipments.
Unfortunately, I don't actually know. The most frustrating thing for me was the fact that it was so difficult to get useful information out of PrimeCraft after the order had been placed and before it was fulfilled, which was astonishing because until that point, they'd been really good at communication. When I first contacted them, they got back to me, and I mean, it's Pakistan, so they're awake when I'm asleep and stuff. So it, I mean, I expected that anytime I send a message, it will take a day or two before I get a reply back. And I suspect they only have one, maybe two, but probably only one employee that actually speaks good English. So I mean, if he's not there, nobody else can answer my email. And there was at least one point when it took a week to get a reply back, and it was because he'd been traveling.
Oh, geez. Okay. So
I just take for granted that if I have a problem request, I mean, I need to get all of my stuff in one message and send it off and then hopefully get the reply back. And so I'd send up going, what's going on? And then I wouldn't hear anything. And I wouldn't, you know, and a week later I'd get a reply back. Oh, it will be soon. I'm like, that wasn't what I asked. So there were three or four points when I'd been told, okay, here's the ship date. And then it slipped. And I really don't know what the first couple of slips were about. The last one, Ali is the name of my contact. He basically said what had happened was that one of the employees had installed a bunch of grommets and they'd done them wrong. And so they had to go back in the bags and pull all the grommets out and reset them.
And
the grommet removal and replacement added, and that was like a three weeks beyond. That was the last long delay before they finally got shipped. But I'm like, okay, but what about what was the other reason? Why did it take so long for you to even tell me that? So, and as I think we've alluded to, my next campaign, which hopefully will be live by the time this podcast goes out, is for more bags. And before deciding to do a follow-up on the bags, I talked like, okay, this was a big problem with the last one. Look, I don't mind if something comes up and it's late, what I mind is you not telling me as soon as you know. You know, maybe it's a cultural thing. Maybe you hate to say there's a problem, but please get over that. I would be much happier if you say, "Oh, we're having problems getting this leather. We may still be able to do it on time, but it may be a couple weeks late." You tell me that, and then you come back and say, "Oh, nope, good news, we got it." That's way better than not telling me because you think it'll work and then it not working and me finding out afterward. Please, please, please do that. And he's like, yes, I understand. I mean, in every other way, this guy has demonstrated to me that he's very concerned about ongoing. He also is committed to quality. I mean, one thing he told me was, hey, if any of the grommets ever pop out, I mean, I had one of my early bags that he'd sent me as a sample that didn't have grommets but had the folded over edge. The edge came unglued and it kind of peeled back up. And I sent him a picture. This is my bag. It's my personal bag, but it came apart like this. And so if a customer of mine does that, I'm just going to tell them I'll replace the bag or whatever. And he's like, if that happens, we will replace the bag. We will send you a replacement. So he unconditionally guaranteed the product he was sending me so that I could offer the same thing to him. I'm like, okay.
That's fantastic.
That's the kind of service. So that's generally the impression I've got with him, which was why once the order started slipping, it was like, you know, this is completely unlike the way it was before. I'm confused. It's like if they'd been less communicative, then I would have added more time in. It's like, well, I don't know if they're going to make their deadline or not, but I was confident they would hit their deadline because they'd been so good up to that point. So anyway, he's sworn up and down that the problems that occurred last time will be taken care of, that now, you know, they've done it now once, so the second time should be easier. And I'm like, okay, I'll do it again. Nevertheless, I'm still going to add a lot more time into my schedule this time around, just in case. And of course, I did not realize, this was stupid, this is my own fault, that it was going to take a while to clear customs. I'm like, hey, it's got in the U.S. Oh, right. And then there's stuff that happens before I'm allowed to see them. So there was almost an extra week lost there that I had never originally planned for because I didn't know that I needed to. I'd never imported anything before. So that's going to the schedule, too. So, yeah, this next campaign, I'm saying, okay, if I get this launched now and we close before the end of July, I am fairly certain you'll have your bags by Christmas. Probably sooner, but definitely by Christmas.
That's fair. So are we looking at – I mean, I don't know how much you're willing to disclose. Are we looking at basically the same product, or are there going to be changes to the lineup this time?
There are some changes. The original Ultimate Gamers bag was really because during the very first Penny Gems campaign, some people had said, hey, I want something to put them in. And I'm like, I've already launched this campaign. I've got 3 weeks until it ends. You expect me to find some kind of bag in 3 weeks? I'm not even going to try. That's crazy. And when it was over and I started looking for bags, originally I'm like, well, I should do cloth and leathers. Leather if you want the fancy and cloth if you want the plain. And I started looking, and wow, the first thing that came up on Alibaba was like there was 120,000 different companies that would offer me cloth bags. And I'm like, oh my, and some of them were like horrible looking, fuzzy. I'm like, you know what? People can make their own cloth bags. This is a fancy product. I want a really good, I'll just do really, really snazzy leather bags, which will simplify things for me. And people can do their own cloth if they're too cheap to get the leather. And so then I started hunting for a manufacturer that could do the leather bags. And when I found PrimeCraft's website, I'm like, oh, they already make bags. They have a dice bag as well as other things, gloves and things they make. They seem pretty good. I'll contact them. And they said, well, you know, okay, we'll make you some samples and send them to you. And I'm like, suede would be fine. I think a suede bag would be great. Well, they didn't listen to me. They included both the two suede samples I wanted as well as another suede sample and a sample of the what you have, the split finished goat hide, the Coretta leather. And I picked up that and like, oh, this is something other than what I ordered. Oh my gosh, this feels fabulous. Screw the suede. I want this. They were right. I was wrong. This is way better. It costs about 80% more than the suede does. It's a lot more expensive. But I'm like, not expensive enough. This is super duper. Oh, I love this bag. Yeah. So things, I mean, they kept doing things like that. They're like, yes, you usually send me a couple extra samples. You keep showing. They said, we will emboss your logo for free. I'm like, oh, well, then I need a logo. I need to have a logo for you to emboss because embossed leather looks great. You know, and so then they did it and sent me a sample. I'm like, wait, you did the whole dye before I even placed an order? Wow, okay. You know, and so, and I think, Brian, I think you got the unembossed bag.
I got the unembossed. I foolishly got the unembossed one. Brian, you did get the embossed one, correct?
Speaking of customer service, I mistakenly got the embossed bag, which you promptly and cheerfully replaced with the unembossed.
Silly you.
When I saw an embossed bag, I immediately regretted my decision. If I get one during this round, which I likely will, I will be getting an embossed model if that is an option.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so, you know, and it's like, okay, I understand from the first Penny Gems campaign, people who are just like allergic to any sort of company logo thing. It's like, I don't want to be an advertisement. I just want it plain. I'm like, okay, but it's not like I have my name on it. It's just a shape. And do you not understand how beautiful embossed leather looks? It looks so nice. You know, that's to me, I was like, yeah, I want it embossed because it looks cool when leather's embossed. It's a great look. But so when the last campaign finished, I, as you guys hopefully are aware, I did a little survey, you know, saying, okay, how many of you, because some of you have made this comment that now that you've gotten your bags, you wished you'd gotten more. So how many of you would like more bags and how many more bags do you want? And I hoped to sell at least, I needed to sell at least 500 leather bags in order to make my minimum with PrimeCraft. I ended up selling 1,100 leather bags to, I forget exactly how many backers. But when the survey was done, just in the people who had already bought bags, I had demand for somewhere between 200 and 400 more.
Wow.
Wow. That's a lot of people who still want – that's just among people who already have them and shouldn't need them. Okay, I guess it's worth doing another time. I'll look into that. And it took a lot longer than I thought to get around to it, but it always does. Kickstarter campaigns are very time-consuming to start. But so I was looking into that. But one of the things I comment at some point, it's like, you know, only like 10 to 20%. I have to go back and look. It's been long enough now since I remember since the statistics that I don't remember them exactly. But a fairly small percentage of people actually ordered the unembossed bags. Most people got them with the logo embossed. So I'm like, okay, not that many people wanted the unembossed. So I think I'm not going to offer that because I really need to cut down on the number of options I'm offering. It makes things way complicated. I got an email back going, please don't do that. So it turned out that although not many people want the unembossed, the people who do really, really want the unembossed. So I'm like, okay, all right. I will still offer the unembossed as an option. So it will be an option. The lamp is one option. The other option that I will be offering with the new campaign, if – and it's going to be a stretch goal. If people meet the stretch goal, There's going to be a new color, Kickstarter green, bright green.
Yes, yes, I love green, and I love Kickstarter green in particular.
And our original, the original green, the green for the original bags was actually pretty dark. It's kind of a forest green. So I'm like, Ali, can you do – now, the thing I learned from Kickstarter, it's PrimeCraft, they didn't even tell me this. I'm like, why didn't you say something? Because I'd originally asked, can I get these colors in the same colors the penny gems come in? Because I want people to be able to get a set of eight and have each, you know, the yellow penny gems in the yellow bag or whatever. Well, since most of their sales are gloves and things, most of the leather they do is brown. That's what people get, brown and black. The yellow, the orange, and I think the purple were all custom-dyed leather for this product.
Wow.
They had to do special. And I'd asked at one point about, it's like, well, what about the auxiliary colors? Pink. I bet I could sell some pink bags. And he's like, well, we'd like to do a minimum of 200 hides or 200 bags because of the number of hides we have to dye. I'm like, I am not going to sell 200 pink bags. And he's like, oh, we'll do it anyway. I'm like, no, don't be ridiculous. I do not want you dyeing a whole bunch of pink leather sitting around just to give me, I don't know, 30 or 40 pink bags for the people who want them. Not, no. But you know, he obviously regretted even telling me that there was a minimum because he was perfectly happy to sell through the minimum. Like, don't be ridiculous. So I did not know that the other colors had also been custom dye jobs. So I'm like, okay, now I'm asking for a new green. I'm going to make sure that there's going to actually be use for this green. But the other thing, and again, it's going to be a stretch goal. All right, people, pony up, is not only will you be able to get a Kickstarter green, but you will also be able to get Kickstarter's K embossed on the bag.
Ah.
So that if you backed, say, Realm Coins or Poker Chips for Gamers or Futuristic Money, you can put it in a bag that says, I got this on Kickstarter. It has the K and it's Kickstarter green.
I will sing that as I gloat.
Yes. I'm like, I think there's a lot of people who, because there's a lot of other Kickstarter campaigns and projects that have completed that give you a bunch of things. There's, you know, a bunch of different kinds of money. There's tokens, there's pieces, there's miniatures. I'm like, there are all sorts of things that other people have done that you want to put in a bag. I'm going to offer a bag that you can put them in that says, I got this on Kickstarter. So there'll be blank, my electric lamp, or the K.
I dig it. And I just made the connection between your logo and electric lamp, by the way.
Oh. they say, hey, we will emboss your logo on it. I'm like, I don't have a logo. I've just been taking the words improbable objects and kind of making a little curve out of them. I should have a logo. I mean, I've done logo design for years. It's one of my things. Why don't I have a logo? I should do a logo, and it needs to be a logo that will look awesome when it's embossed in a leather bag. Okay. So that's one extra requirement. Now, the usual requirements for a logo are it needs to be something that looks good in black and white. I mean, there are some logos. Apple had one for years that was all stripy and colored, but oh, that's a pain in the ass to deal with. You really don't want a logo to have colors in it. It should be something you could do in a silhouette. That way it looks good small. It looks good when it's a little tiny icon in your menu bar or whatever. So it needs to be black and white under most cases. There are some logos that work that are like black and gray and white or black and a color and white, but really it's much better if you can just stick with one solid shape. Okay. It needs to be something that is very distinctive even when it's tiny. You want a logo that you can shrink down without it becoming a little blurry blotch. And I wanted something that would look good on leather. Then on top of that, I have a particular problem because the name of my company is Improbable Objects. A logo should be something that even if you see it out of the corner of your eye, you recognize it. It's a shape. It's a shape so distinct. It's not like a dot. You know, if you have a dot, no one's going to know it's your logo if they don't look at it straight on. Great, it's a circle, you know. But IBM has their three letters with the stripes. You don't have to see very much of it to know it's IBM's logo. You can see like a little corner of it, and you'll go, oh, that's IBM's logo. That's General Electric's swirly with the little petals on it, you know. Microsoft, their M. Apple and their Apple with the bite, you know. These shapes that are immediately recognizable. But the name of my company says that what I do are things you've never seen before. I have to have a shape that's immediately recognizable, but you've never seen it before. Wait a minute. This could be a problem. I see a paradox here. How is this going to work? And I'm sitting around going, all right, never seen before, but immediately. And then, poof, flash bulb. It's really a shame that you know, nobody has flash. Strobes don't sound the same. There was that noise that the old-fashioned flash bulb made that was such this perfect I had an idea noise, and now no one ever hears it anymore.
Yeah, it had a certain character to it.
It's kind of fumpy, poofy. Yeah, it was great. It's a great noise. I gotta get a sample of that sometime so I can play it when I have a good idea. Boom! Yes, play the sound. Boom! But it's like, oh, the Aladdin's lamp. Everyone knows that shape. But I'm gonna change the handle and put the power cord on it. No one's ever seen that before, but the overall silhouette is immediately distinctive. On top of that, it's a fantasy shape. I'm doing games. I'm doing leisure stuff. Aladdin's lamp was part of a cave of treasures. It implies, you know, granting wishes and being rich and good fortune. It's a luxury item. I'm like, yes, this is perfect. This is a fabulous symbol. I love it. I am happy as a basket of clams. I don't know why clams are happy, but I'm told they are. It was just this brainstorm that ended up, you know, leaving a whole puddle of water of warm the storm all over the place because it was so good. I was tickled mauve with delight when that idea popped into my head.
On clams, I will say that if you had a giant, valuable stone in your belly, you might also be happy and smiling all the time.
Or uncomfortable.
yes. Maybe they're happy to be put out of their misery when caught because they want that painful, the mother of all gallstones removed. Who knows?
Yeah. So yeah, any listeners who are on the edge, I encourage you, really, no, get it embossed. The leather looks so cool embossed. And if you hate it, you can always just turn it around. It only gets embossed on one side.
Just don't show people the other side of the bag.
Yeah, if it really bugs you that much. But don't be like you and go unembossed and then go, oh, what was I thinking?
It was sad.
But there are reasons. So yellow and orange were the least popular colors. And since for this campaign, I'm like, you know what? I don't need to match penny gems because that was what the last campaign was for. This is about – because it became clear people loved being able to customize. That hadn't really been in my head when I started. I'm like, okay, here are the bags you need for your penny gems. You need all these colors. Or maybe you want black and have the drawstrings colored. I guess you could go either way. And I couldn't decide. I couldn't decide which one I would like better, so I offered both. And I'm like, well, okay, so you might as well just pick a color and a drawstring any way you want. And so kind of accidentally, I ended up creating what was, in the end, 1,320 different options on what bag you could get. Because you could get small, medium, or large. You could get one of the 8 colors that I'd planned to offer, black, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, purple, and then instead of white, I said gray. Because I'm like, you know, white leather is probably just going to get dirty, so we don't want to do white. So I'll do gray instead of white. And then PrimeCraft said, well, you know, we have light brown, medium brown, and dark brown. So I'm like, okay, sure, let's add those. And that turned out to be very popular. So there was 11 colors. And then there were the 8 or 9 different colors of drawstrings. And then someone asked about grommets, and I'm like, oh, I don't know. I didn't even think about that. And I asked them to say, yes, we can do grommets. We have 3 colors. I'm like, okay, so you can get no grommets or black grommets or gold grommets or silver grommets. Well, in the end, you know, I'm like, wow, so of the 1,320 possible different bags, I ended up getting over 500 of them in all the different combinations that people got. You know, and there were 300 people who managed to order a bag that was unique, that nobody else had ordered exactly that combination of grommet and size and color and drawstring color. So, and at one point I sent a little notice to everybody, say, hey, congratulations, if your little invoice has a star by it on one of the bags, that star means that bag is one of a kind, just so you know. So clearly the option to make exactly the bag they wanted and be able to pick these options was very popular because we had so many different options. People did not just keep going for black with black and black grommets, like, although that was the most popular thing, but not nearly as much as I thought. So I'm like, okay.
Really? I'm kind of shocked to hear that people are that. I don't want to judge anybody's choices, but I mean, orange.
It's classic black. It doesn't draw attention to itself. It's very elegant and understated. It's just for carrying something. It's not trying to be showy. I understand, you know.
And orange was the least popular because I'm slightly offended having picked an orange bag.
I think yellow was a little – but, yeah, yellow and orange came in least popular. I mean, it wasn't like they were hated, but I published the stats on one of the updates to the campaign. You could go back and check it.
Look, yeah.
I broke down, like, by color and by bag size and some things like this, what were all the most popular options and some of the least popular options, better than zero. But yeah, so like, okay, customization was very popular. So I'm dropping yellow and orange because I mean, I don't, the yellow in particular, I'm like, it's not a very pretty yellow. It's kind of a mustard, rather than a bright yellow. So I don't personally find it a particularly attractive color. And I'm like, yeah, no one seemed to really want it, so out. I need to cut down on my options. Grommets were very popular. They're unnecessary. I mean, even my large bag without the grommets, loaded with penny gems, which means it weighs almost 2 pounds and is kind of a dangerous weapon, it still has not actually distorted the leather, which I'm like, it still feels so soft. I can't believe it hasn't, like, misshapen at all. No. So it doesn't need it even when it's heavily loaded. But the grommets do make it easier to make the cord slide, so it's easier to open and close. And I'm like, and everyone wanted them, so I'm like, okay, all bags will have grommets. They will all have black grommets. I'm going to get rid of that choice because it's not that important. But another request, and the small bag was specifically for people who were getting needed a bunch of bags and because they wanted to have a separate bag for each penny gem. The small bag is very small. So I'm like, we're not doing small bags. Unless you're doing penny gems, that's really too small to hold much of anything. So it's going to be medium and large, extra large, and probably a double extra large or huge. So there are going to be some much larger options than before. So I'm not getting down on the number of sizes of bags. I'm increasing the number of sizes of bags, but it's going to be medium, large, and two sizes above that.
Wow.
And then the colors, I'm dropping yellow and orange, but I'm adding Kickstarter green, I hope, if there's enough interest in it. So colors only got a little bit less. Grommets got less. But there's going to be some new drawstring colors, because one of the other things I learned from PrimeCraft is the way they make the drawstrings is they get the cord and the plastic in from their Chinese manufacturer or whatever, and then they dye them. Everything that gets white, they dye them to match. And they can do those one at a time. It's not like they need a whole lot. It's not like the leather. So if four people want chartreuse, fine. So I'm going to add lavender and pink as drawstring colors.
Very nice.
For people who want something a little... Because until now, most of the bags have not been doing any kind of pastel. It's all bright, saturated jewel tones. I'm like, some people might like... So, and there may be other colors added as stretch goals, depending on how people, how excited people get about buying bags. But add a couple drawstring colors. But the other thing, I'm very excited about this. This is brand new news. This is breaking news here that nobody has heard before. It occurred to me a couple weeks ago, what else might people, one of the problems I have, I got a bunch of bags for myself to keep penny gems in is when I'm going someplace, I want to show them off. And the problem I get there, I'm like, one of these has my wound counters, and one of these has the Fusel chips, and one of these – which one was it again? I put the gray one was the dichotomy or what? Crap. I picked out colors to help me figure this out, but I don't remember what I did. Maybe I need to put labels on them or something. So I was like, other people besides me might actually want to personalize them. I wonder if I can do that. Well, it turns out I cannot, stamp the leather. If you, go to a Western store and get a belt, they'll have, things embossed in it, blind stamped into it, where it's dented in as opposed to the embossed logo, which sticks out. But this leather is so soft that if you tried to blind stamp, it would probably come right back out again after just a little bit of using the bag as the leather flexed, and B, anything strong enough to actually leave an impression might cut the leather right through so that you can't stamp your name into it. You can, however, laser burn it. Slap the bag into a laser cutter, and it scans across, and it can brand, basically, writing into the bag.
Oh, interesting.
I have a bag here. I wish I could show it to you. I'm going to get photos up soon. It contains special penny gems I made for myself that are on this. They look like regular penny gems, but the underlying material isn't just shiny silver. It's like a foiled card. It has that kind of rainbow effect to it. So Dave's personal foiled penny gems. And so the bag now says iridescent. In beautiful, clean, black type. It's really cool. So, again, it's going to be a stretch goal. It's going to be a very early stretch goal. Customized writing. You'll be able to, for an extra $5, you'll be able to get your name or a word burned onto your bag.
That is cool. And the question that immediately springs to mind is that going to result in you feverishly doing this yourself, adding the laser-etched name, or is it something that the manufacturer can do?
It's not going to be done in Pakistan. I don't know if they have it, and I don't – I would be a little worried about making – already the order I'm sending them is ridiculously complicated. I mean, normally they get I would like to buy gloves from you. I need 500 pairs of large, 500 pairs of medium and small in brown, and then the same in black. I sent them an order with 550 different items that they had to – it was ridiculous. I have to say, when I did finally get the order, it was very impressive. Every bag was packaged in its own little Ziploc. And then all the bags that were the same were put in a larger Ziploc. So they're all grouped together. And then they used the code numbers I came up with for them. So each bag had my identification code so I could tell what it was. And then those were put in smaller white – you remember, may recall the smaller white boxes. And then there was a label on the top of that box that said exactly what bags were in it. Yes. And then I got 20 of those white boxes shipped to me in four large boxes. So I popped this thing open, and I was like, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if I just got this giant sack full of bags, and then I have to go through and sort out and figure out what I've got. Nope. Every single bag was labeled exactly as to what it was. It was awesome. So I'm like, okay. I mean, I sent you an order that was way the heck more complicated than anything that either you or I had expected when we started this, and you did a remarkably good job of giving me exactly what I wanted and making it very easy for me to go through, because it was so late. What I would have wanted to have done, what I really wanted to do, is like print out a list of all the bags I was supposed to have and then go and check and say, okay, do we have this many? Do we, you know, take inventory and make sure that every bag that we were supposed to have, we did have. In the end, it was pretty clear that a couple of them, we were short a couple of bags and had a couple of extra, a few of them were, like, a few were wrong, maybe three or four, not many. But it would have been nice to know at the beginning, if I'd done that right away, I could have then ordered replacements and probably had them in time to fill the order. But I'm like, I just got to get started. So I just kept track as we sent them out. And when we got to the last few, that was when I figured out what we'd gotten wrong. So next time I'm going to take inventory. But it would have been so easy to do it because they did such a great level of labeling. I don't want to make them have to try and deal with this. I mean, okay, given that English isn't even necessarily going to be whoever's doing its language, there's all kinds of opportunities for things to go wrong, and I have to I'd rather do that locally. So I looked around, and what I found just outside of town, I mean, she's like 7 minutes from my house, is a woman who has been laser burning custom leather for almost 30 years. Her first laser burner cutter, back when they didn't cut, they were just used for, like, trophies and things, she told me this, came with the serial number of Beta 2 from Universal. I forget. It's not Epilogue, the most commonly known laser cutting company now, but it's one of the competitors. She had one of their very first machines way back when, and she's been doing this for years. So I found her through a referral from someone else and dropped in and to her shop and said, so this is what I want to do. And she's like, great. Do you have a bag? Yes, I brought some to show her. It's like, okay, what would you like to say? I'm like, this is the bag I keep these in. How about iridescent? What font do you want? What font do you have? I've got thousands of fonts. So do I. Okay, well, so as it turned out, the font I asked for, Fritz Quadrata, she didn't have. So she promptly goes to the internet, finds it, copy, downloads it, installs it. I'm like, dang, yes. And then burned it. Just like that.
Wow, so right in your own backyard, you've got the capacity for this.
Right in my own backyard. I can walk them over to her. Yes, they're going to be done locally. Like, awesome. That's perfect. Something goes wrong, I can go right over and say, can you make a new one?
Fantastic.
Yay! Which, you know, this specific level of customization, that's a very good thing. So, yeah, it's not even Seattle. It's right outside of Walla Walla, right outside of town. With someone awesome. Who's been doing it for years and knows, yeah, I'm like, this is ideal. So yes, custom writing. The other thing I am hoping to offer, and this is more tentative, if another Kickstarter project like Realm Coins or whatever, and the tricky thing is I have to try and get content. The thing is that the best way for one of those groups of people to find out about the custom leather bags they could get with them is for somebody who backed it to post to their comment board or contact the company. There's kind of this instinctive negative reaction if the person who makes something shows up, someone says, hey, I've got this great product that you want. I've seen some remarkably hostile reactions even when it wasn't. I'm like, yeah, I don't run around like pushing penny gems online because that there are people who just hate that, perhaps unreasonably, but they hate that. So it's much better if somebody who isn't me does it. So I'm like, you know, if someone who backed that goes there and says, hey, and can get the attention of the people who did it, and they're like, oh, yeah. And they then send out a message saying, okay, you know, and I'll use Realm Coins because I have some of theirs and I backed that campaign way back when, I think. Was it them or was it someone else? No, actually, RealmCoin, someone gave me a few of those. It was Poker Chips for Gamers. I did back Poker Chips for Gamers. So the Poker Chips for Gamers people say, oh, yeah, you know what? We've heard about this now and we do like it. I'm like, great. If you will send out a message to the people who backed your campaign, and, you know, maybe a long time since they did it now, but you still got their list, and they presumably most of them still getting email, and tell them, if you like and give me the artwork, I will make your logo available for people to put on their bag. So that if you get Realm Coins or Poker Chips for Gamers, you can have the bag labeled Realm Coins or Poker Chips for Gamers or Modern Money or whatever symbol that represents them. It's like, give me your artwork, and I will make it be an option available that people can get on the bag so that they know what they're putting in it.
That is cool.
Wouldn't that be cool?
It would be. And I mean, there you have it, folks. I to not back this round would be foolish. You've got maximum flexibility. You're going to get a top quality bag customized really to an absurd level, in my opinion.
Yeah, well, that's the fun part, you know. It's like, yeah. Now, my plan is, so then the option, the getting your name on it or whatever, that goes on the, let's call it the front of the bag, which you may or may not have gotten embossed, but it will go below the logo because that's the part that'll tend to be fat. I was originally going to put it above it. I'm like, oh no, wait, that's the part that kind of squinches up when you close it, so that's no good. Let's put it below. So there's on most of the bags, there should be room for one or possibly two lines of type. If you want the logo of the product, that's going to go on the other side of the bag in the middle.
Okay.
So you can have both. You can have both your name on it on the embossed side, and then you can have the product on the other side of the bag. So you can get the bags unembossed. You aren't going to be able to get a logo burned onto it, though. So look, if you don't want it embossed, then how come you think you can get away with having this Realm Coins or whatever? If you're going to have Realm Coins, then I get to put my lamp on the other side. That's my deal. It's like, look, smoothing is not your thing if you're going to get the thing on it. So you'll just have to turn it over. So one side will have the Improbable Objects logo lamp embossed in the, you know, texture. The other side can then have burned or filled in the whatever it is you're putting in it.
Mm.
That, or you can have the K on the other side.
Sounds like a fair trade.
But it's like, yeah, I'm not letting you do the symbol of the thing you're putting in it if you're going to then not let me put something on the other side. Because, hello, I put a lot of work into this project.
Yeah, fair's fair. So what about it, Brian, Eric? Brian, I know you are already a satisfied customer. Do you think you'll be going back? And Eric, I don't know how many games you play such that you have a need for a storage bag, but are either of you interested?
I'm going to tell you my dilemma, and Tom, I think you already know my dilemma. And it's not that it doesn't sound like a wonderful product. I don't buy leather. So when you were like, cloth option, I went, ooh. And then you were like, no cloth option, I'm like, okay.
I forgot about that.
That is a legitimate dilemma. Now, for the last campaign, that did come, like 3 or 4 people asked about that. I'm like, yeah, leather. I'm like, okay. So I checked with PrimeCraft. It's like, do you do faux leather? It's like, oh, yes, we can do that. So I offered vinyl as an option. Of the 1,170 bags, 4 of them were vinyl. People asked for it. They didn't buy them. I'm like, yeah, that was way too much of a hassle for not anyone actually going and then getting the bag. So this time around, I am not offering faux leather.
And I can understand that.
Because, you know, despite the hue and cry, people didn't just actually do it. And honestly, ew. I mean, I touched those bags, and I'm like, and they couldn't be embossed because of the nature of the material. I'm like, yeah, this stuff does not feel good. This is not a quality experience. Great, it's not animal. So for, you know, I appreciate it, but it's like, I'm a little embarrassed to offer this, even though it's by request and only for people who wanted it. So I'm like, yeah, I'm not enthusiastic about it, and people didn't pay for it. So I'm like, yeah, if this is not your material, I understand that. And I'm certainly not going to sneer at anyone who's like, you know, yeah, they're great bags, but made from a creature's skin, ew, no, not my thing, don't want to. That is perfectly reasonable, and that means you will have to, you know, get,
right.
If you want a bag, you need to go to someone other than this, because that's just not what I'm going for here.
Oh, and I've more than accepted that companies can't appeal to everyone. I mean, if your market is, you know, 99% wants the leather product, then there's no reason for you to appeal to a 1% market.
You know, and the whole system, I mean, like, okay, the embossing, it only works on leather. The laser burning, it isn't going to work on cloth. It wouldn't work on the vinyl. I mean, all the support is about this particular medium. And so it's like, yeah, it's starting over from scratch to offer another option. So it's like, that would be a different thing. And but so Eric, there's no point in trying to mix them together.
But Eric, let me remind you or tell you, you're probably not aware of this. This particular species of goat is known as the Pakistani Alpine goat. It actually sheds its skin like a reptile. And this is just found leather. This is not taken from a killed animal.
Oh, well, that's fine then.
Perhaps a bit more realistically. Pakistan, despite its size, is the number 3 in the world for countries raising goats. They have a huge number of goats, which they eat. Goats are food. The leather is a byproduct. It is from an animal, but it's not from an animal that was killed for its skin.
Right. I mean, it's like you're making something out of a napkin discarded at a Golden Corral, Eric. It's sort of just incidental to the meal. It's not the meal itself.
But I don't partake in the food either. So
yeah, you know, it's like now, you know. So if someone's concern is specifically I don't want an animal that was killed for this, then that's reassuring. But if it's like I don't want animal skin to be a thing, then that doesn't help. It still came from a goat.
Right. Yeah, I see it as an improvement over, let's say, like the fur trade, where the animals are just discarded or, you know, turned into more food for animals.
Yeah, which is really reprehensible, and I did ask a fair number of questions of Ali, as well as doing a bunch of my own research. That's why I know that Pakistan's the number 3, is I found that out by digging into where does this leather come from and what are likely. Yeah, and I'm like, no, I mean, Ali did not swear to me, oh yes, these are, you know, food animals. He didn't specifically tell me that, but. But I told him about some of the concerns of my customers, and he said, no, this is, you know, we're not killing goats just for this. And the evidence from just the way Pakistan works and the fact that they've been doing leather for years and that they do raise goats and they eat goats. Oddly enough, the U.S. is like number 5 in goat raising and exporting. We export a lot of goat meat to other countries.
Did not know that.
Yeah, I know. It's one of the other things that, like, wow, I didn't realize that the U.S. would be that highly ranked in that particular trade, given that we don't eat any of it here, or very little of it, but we're raising and selling them for food. So it's a thing that the U.S. does, too. But it seems pretty clear that it's not one of those things that, like, you know, seals or beaver fur or, yeah. So it's still animals.
So you're not offering it in seal? Because I would buy one in seal. They're jerks.
Yeah.
Eric's objection.
It is leather. And I respect people who have that concern. But it is, I think, to the best of my ability without actually going to Pakistan, it seems to me to be a fairly humane and a reputable source. So I do feel good about that while respecting the fact that it's still animal. And some people, that's just not the right thing. Sure.
So Eric's objections being noted and his speciesism, if that's the species.
I wouldn't even call it an objection. The product sounds great. It's just my particular taste.
Yeah, no, I get it. Yeah, you're not into a dead animal skin. That's fine.
His but, concern. Yeah.
Right, your concern. It's fair. Many people share your convictions. And I know one person who does not is Brian. Brian, to get back to the question I asked you earlier, you think you're going to be getting one?
Oh yeah, I love the idea of the green and the K. That's brilliant. I've got like probably 5 games I'd put in them already, and I'll stock up for future.
You're gonna need to if you keep getting the same green K bag, you're definitely gonna need to put names on them to say what's in the bag.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
And I will soothe myself by telling myself the lie over and over again that this is a shedding goat, and I got the skin from a goat that just kind of left it by the roadside. It's not a big deal.
Yeah. Well, in effect.
Yeah, it's 100% roadkill leather.
There you go. No goats were killed intentionally in the making of this bag. I guess I would just ask if you have any sort of parting advice for somebody who wanted to launch their own product. And I get that you've been through a lot of the ins and outs of Kickstarter, but if you had to sort of give a nutshell advice, you know, if you had to give sort of advice in a nutshell to an aspiring creator, what would that be?
If you're talking about someone who has a game idea, specifically, because of the Golden Age of Kickstarter is over kind of a thing, I would say the first thing is you need to go back to kind of the traditional, the basics. Take it to – there are a number of game conventions in particular that have programs specifically – to assist and promote new games and game designs. Board Game Geek has a whole program where you can pitch to professionals and they can critique what you're doing. GameStorm in Portland has the indie game program where they have opportunities for people to sign up to play test new games. So you can get in there and people will be driven to test it, and then they have forms that they can fill out to provide the feedback. It's great. KublaCon in California has a program like that as well. I know there's one in Atlanta somewhere. There are others. So look around and do that. You know, get your game out. One of the worst mistakes that the beginning game makers often make is that they're afraid someone will steal their idea. Get over that. There are way too many ideas out there. There are way too many people doing games. You're not that special. The risk, the tiny, tiny, tiny risk that someone would think your game is so brilliant that they want to steal it is nothing compared to the value you get from having someone say, oh, it's kind of okay, but it would be better if you did this. Get the exposure. Get as many people seeing it as possible. Get the feedback. Listen to it. Learn how to do it. And then I would say the first thing you should probably do is try pitching it try selling it to the regular channels. The easiest and most profitable way to get a game sold is to have Rio Grande or Paizo say, we like your game, we will publish your game. That's still the ideal situation. If that, you know, and if you try that and it doesn't work, and that means going to Origins or going to Gen Con and arranging there's usually people there from those companies who are prepared to see a certain number of submissions. Check their website, see if they've got a submission program for it. But do your homework and figure out what to do. If that does not work, or for whatever reason you're bound and determined to do Kickstarter, try and find somebody to work with who's done it before. Find a partner, an associate, someone who's done Kickstarter. Having someone who's been through the process once will save you a huge amount of time and effort in not being surprised. They'll have a good idea of what to do, help you steer over around mistakes. So if you can find somebody, and hopefully you'll have met them by going to those game conventions, who'd be interested in working with you, that would be a huge advantage. So that would be my two key pieces of advice at this point. And there's most of the game conventions, it's practically like a requirement these days. What to know about Kickstarter is now pretty much a standard convention panel. You know, every time I've been, I end up roped into the Kickstarter panel because I've done some Kickstarters, and particularly successful Kickstarters. So that's a good one to hit. You know, that's a great place to find people who also have done Kickstarter, who want to do Kickstarter, get the advice. So hit the Kickstarter panel, because there will be one. There always is. A couple of things I'd like to mention, if we've got time.
Absolutely.
Is what's going to happen after the bag campaign, or possibly even before it completes. I'm not sure, but it'll be soon. So while, in particular, last November at Board Game Geek Con, that was where I was really playtesting the magical penny gems to get more feedback on, you know, like what they should have on the sheets, what mix they should have. And I got some great feedback from the magic product designer, who I'd known casually, but he was there, and I'm like, aha! And he's like, oh, you know, I can't actually officially say anything. Of course not. What unofficially can you say? And you gave me some very good advice about, you know, like what would be a good mix for what they're doing that, as well as what's coming up. But a comment I got a couple of times where people are like, oh, are you going to do ones for Netrunner? I'm like, well, you know, I'm doing Magic because a zillion and one people play Magic. I don't know that the new Netrunner is popular enough that would make sense. Well, when the fourth person, just a couple weeks ago, sent me an email going, I'd love to get some that were specific to Netrunner. I'm like, well, here's the thing. I'm not convinced there's a market for it. If you want to find a bunch of people who say that they'd buy it, then I'll consider it. He promptly organized a little email letter writing campaign. I got 30 requests in, and I'm like, okay, fine. Fine. I will start working on Penny Gems for Netrunner. He does not know this yet. I have not told him that I have decided, yes, okay, I will in fact start working on designs. And I'm still kind of waffling on whether or not it's going to be a Kickstarter because of the fact there's all the extra work to Kickstart these days. I got to do the video. I got to do the PR. But probably I will do that. There are penny gems that are going to go on sale on the Etsy store that I'm not going to Kickstart that are brand new. already there is one. For the people who did the magical penny gems, one of the four options was poison counters. What went up for sale yesterday on the Etsy store is a modified version of the poison counter sheet, where half of it is poison counters, and half of it are two new designs that nobody has ever seen that you can use to mark, well, whatever. You know, basically, it's as if you had regular old ordinary penny gems in green or blue or yellow, except that these are actually multicolored, and the symbols on them are a little more mystic-looking, a little more magic-y feeling. They're a little weirder and stranger, not the clean graphic kind of, you know, platonic shapes of the regular penny gems. These are kind of spiky and fuzzy and stuff. So they're more magic-themed. So new design, so that if you buy the poison counter, what you get is poison charge time, and so you get half poison and half charge and time that you can count other things with. As soon as I get them from the manufacturer in Redmond, which will hopefully be in a couple weeks, also will be penny gems with numbers. People have on occasion said, oh, I'd like to get, you know, like denominated ones, like I could use for money or poker chips, but penny gems. And I'm like, you know, poker chips are better poker chips than penny gems are poker chips. But if you want them, I'll think about it. A more compelling thing came up when someone said, oh, I'd like to get ones that would be like the victory point tokens for Small World, where you've got a number on one side and then you've got a blank on the other side, so you can't tell what it is. I'm like, well, you know, I can sell you a bunch of numbers, and then you can put something else in the back, and then they could be one-sided or two-sided. It's up to you. Anyway, penny gems with numbers on them are going to go on sale as soon as I get my first batch in. Brand new kind of penny gem, never before seen, coming soon.
So breaking news, right? I mean, we're actually breaking this? Wow.
Yep. I have hinted at the denominated ones before, but I haven't had a final schedule. I finally finished the designs and sent them off and said, okay, make me a bunch. So it's been known they were coming one of these days, but now it's they're coming as soon as I get them. They will go up on – and those I'm not going to do a Kickstarter campaign. I'm just going to send out the mailing list and tweet about it going, hey, here they are, new ones. When you want them, come get them. So I'm not making a whole bunch because I don't think it's going to be a huge rush to get them, but a new kind of penny gem. But the Netrunner ones will probably be kickstarted because that gives me a better idea of exactly how many I need and what kind of demand it is. Now, the downside, the real downside to me is that when I do a Kickstarter, then when it closes, now all of a sudden I need thousands. Whereas with the denominated ones, because it's not Kickstarted, they like, oh, someone wants some, and I'll get some more. And so that way I'm not frantically trying to make a whole bunch of them all at once. It's much more steady, and that's much easier to manage. So that's kind of nice. But that will be next.
That sounds marvelous. Well, I think I might be able to prime you for the next one. And I saw a prototype of it when I was at your place to pick up my bag. It was this pretty intricate looking Wonder Box.
The Wonder Box. Yeah. That, unfortunately, is almost certainly postponed.
Okay, so that wasn't what you were driving at.
Yeah, that's not the next one. But I did want to cover that because a lot of people have seen it. Now, the question is, which one did you see? Do you remember what it was made out of? Because the Mark I was made out of poplar. The Mark II was made out of cherry.
I don't recall whether I saw Mark I or II, but it was impressive.
Did it have felt in it?
I cannot recall.
Yeah, I think you may have only seen the Mark I. Because it was last. I'm pretty sure the Mark II was finished because it was in time. It was in time to take it to Board Game Geek. It was like last summer, and I'm pretty sure that you got the bags last February, Mark? No, it was in the fall. It was like September, October was when they went out. Yeah, so I think I had the Mark I done, not the Mark II. So the Mark II had an extra drawer. It's got felt in it. It's much fancier. But it was and the Mark II was a pain in the butt to make, in part because I wanted it to fit better and slide more smoothly. But in the process, I realized that was not going to be the last one. I'm like, oh, no, there's a bunch of new things I want to do now. So the Mark III, I have the plans for. And one very exciting – one big question was, how will I have them made? Because I am not about to – I don't want to make 50 or 100 of those boxes. It requires a very high degree of woodworking skill. It's cabinet making. You know, it's like intricate cabinet making because all the different layers slide together, and you should be able to slide them together in any order, which means each piece of wood needs to fit very closely. And to keep it from falling apart, they have to fit – well, it was fascinating. I showed the prototype – I don't know if you know the other Kickstarter project, Artisan Dice. Are you familiar with that one?
Incredibly fancy wood tool,
yeah.
Dice. Yeah.
So this guy had made some dice out of really cool pieces of wood and showed them to his friends. And his friends were like, oh, you should like kickstart those and make – because people would love those. So he's like, okay, yeah, I can make these dice out of wood. I'm looking to raise, I think it was like $300 or maybe $1,000. That's enough to make it worth it. He ended up raising over $1 million in orders.
Wow. Or
hundreds of, maybe 800,000. It was some phenomenal number. So instead of just doing a couple, he ended up hiring a bunch of his friends, buying all the woodworking equipment he had twice over again, and spending the next year and a half filling the orders that he had. Congratulations! You just accidentally came up with a whole new job for yourself and a company. Boom! Yeah. But he was at Board Game Geek Con, and so I'm like, hey, I backed that project at the very. I'm like, I'm very poor, so I backed it at 3 square dice of whatever you have left over. Randomly selected wooden dice. I'm like, well, they're beautiful. Or maybe it's 4, but anyway. But it was, I was unprepared to invest. It was still $30 or something like that. But I'm like, they're very cool. I love them. So it was great to be able to go to talk to him. And I showed him my box, and he's like, oh my gosh. I'm like, yeah. And the problem is that it's clear to make it really work well. The tolerances are less than 1/100 of an inch, which is the smallest I can measure. He's like, yeah, it's about 2 or 3 thousandths of an inch. I mean, he knew exactly what the tolerance had to be because his gear would do that. My equipment wasn't calibrated to that level of precision. I'm like, yeah, that's what I was afraid of. This is really precise work, and wood is not a great material to be precise in. It expands and contracts. It's got grain. It's kind of finicky. So it's a difficult project to do, and I'm like, this is not a good thing for me. I am not a cabinet maker. I'm a designer, but when it comes to actually doing the work, I there's just a little bit of slop in what I do, and I'm like, yeah, I can only get so good. But the other person I ran into, and I played poker with him before, so it wasn't like he was a stranger, but it was just a chance to talk to him, is Robert, the owner of Geek Chic, the company that makes those spectacular, gorgeous, custom-made gaming tables and furniture.
Yes, yes. I can't add enough adjectives to those that you just listed. Those
yeah, articles. they are so lustworthy. And being custom made in America, they're also not cheap. You know, you start adding options and getting one of the fancier ones, and you easily hit $10,000 to $15,000 for this table. So I am very jealous of the people who can actually afford them. I mean, Will Wheaton's tabletop games, that's what they play on. They're playing on a Geek table, so which is why they get thanked at the end of the credits every time. But I was talking to him, and I'm like, yeah, woodworking and stuff. And one of the things that, because the Mark II prototype, I knew that it's like, yeah, the Mark I was very sloppy. I really need someone who knows more about wood than I do to help me make the Mark II. Wait a minute. My dad has a cousin who I know who is a retired ship's carpenter. He used to have to fit wood together so tightly that it didn't leak. I'm like, he would be a good person to help me with this, and he was willing to do it. So he and I spent a number of weeks during the summer a year or so ago making the Mark II. And he had suggested that, he'd recommended cherry for the wood because we needed a wood that was very hard and fine grained so that it wouldn't squeeze or distort much in order to keep the right shape. And when we were done with it, he said, yeah, you might want something even harder like maple. Same reason they make it out of musical instruments out of it. So it's very dense, hard wood. I'm like, yo, great. But I had to borrow a planer in order to get the cherry wood because you can't buy it like in half inch strips. What you do is you buy it as like kind of a rough cut wood, and then you're supposed to shape it down yourself with your own planer and your own jointer. And I'm like, I don't have a planer and a jointer. Hey, Robert, you make these tables, and this piece right here looks like it's half inch maple. Could you make me the maple boards? I could just buy them from you? And he's like, yeah, we could do that. So it was pretty funny. He said, yeah, it's like an ordinary order where you have these 5 steps, except we're only going to do steps 1 and 2 and then stop, and you're going to come get it. I swung by and grabbed my boards after they started making my imaginary table. So I have the maple boards I need. But I was talking to him, and they'd been like backordered 6 to 9 months for quite a while. Despite the cost of their tables, they have more business than they know what to do with. So they finally decided to commit to adding a new production line so that they could get caught up. But a whole new production line would actually get them a little too caught up. So they're like, and what are we going to do to make sure that we keep the second production line busy? And so they've been thinking about the possibility of working with other companies to do special products like the Wonder Box. So he's like, you know, the thing is, you'd have to be able to, you'd have to have a minimum number of orders. So, you know, it's got to be enough for it to be worth us. We're not going to do 5. So I'm okay. Now, the last time I talked to him, this was still very theoretical. They hadn't brought that second production line up yet. You know, I didn't have, so I was like, I don't know what the actual work will be to make it. I don't know how hard it will be for you to do. So clearly you can't tell me how much it will cost or how many is the minimum to do them. you've got to get your stuff settled, and I've got to get the blueprints done. So I finally got the blueprints done, but I got them done too late. I tried to reach Robert, and, well, it's convention season. He is so busy, I can't even find time to get a meeting with him. Like, yeah, which means we will not have it ready in time for Gen Con. And if we don't have it for Gen Con, if I'm going to make that project work, I have to have one at a booth at Gen Con where a whole bunch of gamers, including the ones that actually could afford to buy one, were going to walk by, see it, go, oh my gosh, I have to have this, and place an order. You know, if I'm not doing it through Gen Con, that is so obviously the place to launch that puppy.
Absolutely. That
it's next year. So at this point, the Wonder Box is maybe next year, but it's not going to happen this year. So Penny Gems for Android Netrunner is what's going to follow the leather bags. And what happens after that is less clear. It might be an actual game. Because I do have games that I would kind of like to, you know, like, yeah, I've got some things that I could, other than accessories. And because it's more theoretical and because I don't know how long your listeners want to go before their ears fall off, I'll just kind of cut you tightly. Anyone who goes to the Etsy store, the other products besides the Penny Gems that I do are basically these parking stickers that you can stick in your car that look like, you know, your parking pass to go into, except that they're for places that don't really exist. Hogwarts, Starfleet Academy, Wayne Enterprises, Stark Industries. I was doing those long before I was doing Penny Gems, although I used to only do them once a year for the World Science Fiction Convention, and I would exhibit them in the art show, but now they're for sale there. So the reason the company is called Improbable Objects is because the underlying theme is that I'm making things, as the tagline says, that everyday, the ephemera of your everyday life if you lived in an alternative universe or two. So I love doing that. You know, these things that look totally mass manufactured, totally clean and stamped out, except that they don't belong in this world. We don't have a Hogwarts. Why do you have a parking sticker for it? What? So along those same lines, years ago, the late 80s, actually, it would have been, I was playing one of Infocom's text adventures, in particular Zork Zero. And the first versions of their text adventures, Zork 1 and 2 and 3, they made reference to an imaginary game they called Double Fanucci. Now, like Dragon Poker from the Robert Asprin Myth Adventures books, or like Fizbin from Star Trek the Original Series, this was a game that was obviously intended from the beginning to be absurdly complicated and completely unplayable. A game, an imaginary game of just, you know, undescribable complexity. It's ridiculously hard, cannot possibly ever really, no one could actually do it. It's just a fun imaginary game that's too complicated for words. In Zork Zero, they decided to actually make you have to play a game of Fanucci. And you still don't know what you're doing. I mean, they give you, like, you can under Trump or over bite or muttonate or a bunch of things. And the deck was full of crazy cards and suits and things. And the only thing was you had to win one hand in order to move on. And they'd given you a hint in one of the accessories as to what is. So you have to do this thing. It's one thing that happens, and then you can move on without still really knowing. It's like, I don't know what I was doing, but I knew I had to do that thing, and then I'm done. So off you go. But I played that. I'm like, I want a real deck. I want a real deck with these crazy cards in it, with fromps and ears as a suit and mazes and bugs and ink blots, and that seems really fun. And then I'll just play hearts with it or whatever. I'll play ordinary games, but I'll have this crazy deck. I started working on the icons and the suit symbols and stuff for it, and then I kind of forgot about it for a while. And years later, I was pulling files off the computer that I used to use. It was an Amiga that I was using at the time, and I was archiving my Amiga files and getting them into some place I could get to them on my Macintoshes. And I ran across those. I'm like, oh, yeah, right. I was going to make a Fanucci deck. I should do that. Well, I did. I made myself a Fanucci deck for the fun of it and tried playing hearts. That was a catastrophe. Spades, no. Pinochle, no. I discovered a lot about games played with the standard French playing card deck when I tried to adapt those games to the Fanucci deck and watched them fail. Because a standard playing card deck only has four suits, which means any card you draw, there's a 25% chance it's the same suit as one that someone else played. So you can follow suits. The Fanucci deck has 15 suits. So the chances that any card you draw matches the suit on the table is less than 10%. Trick-taking games, fail, all of them. Any game where you can deal out the whole hand, hearts or pinnacle, fails because a Finucci deck is 172 cards. I mean, all these things that I didn't realize were required to make the game work because of the particular structure of hearts, clubs, diamonds, and spades. I'm like, wow. That's very interesting.
Go figure that generations of sort of gaming geeks before us came up with these essential
rules. The games
rules.
We play have molded themselves to fit very, well, fairly neatly with the cards that we have. So I said to myself, okay, well, that means that there should be at least as many other games that no one's discovered yet that you played with a Finucci deck. But no one did it because we never had a Finucci deck. So I started trying to do new games for the Finucci deck. And I came up with a few. And I still sort of thought of that as just like, it's a fun thing. I've got some games I can play with it, and the Finucci deck itself is kind of neat. And of course, my poor parents, they often are the victims of my play. The first time I brought Roborally home, or the first time I brought Magic home and taught them how to play that when we were still prototyping it, they're like, oh, okay. And I came home with another game, and they're like, oh, I think you'll like this. Like, yeah, the last game you brought home was really complicated. And we're like, no, you'll like this one better. Trust me. That was The Great Dalmudi. And they did like The Great Dalmudi a lot better than like Magic. So I taught them what was at the time Flathead Rummy, one of the games that I came up with for the deck. And I gave them a deck, so they had it, but I didn't think too much of it. And then they came back from a Thanksgiving where they'd gone to Chicago to visit my brother and his family and their grandkids. And they said, oh, yeah, and we got out your deck and we played one of those games. And I'm thinking to myself, wait. I wasn't there, and I didn't make you play my game, and you did it anyway because you wanted to? Instead of Phase 10 or Uno or Rummy Cube or some of the other games I know they have?
Wow, huh. that's quite an endorsement.
Maybe it's better than I think. Now, part of it is, for whatever reason, the games that tend to come out of my head tend to be more casual than like what a really hardcore gamer wants. I'm not doing History of the World. Which in a way is bad because it means the people that I know the best that play games will often find them a little too simple. It's like, this isn't, I mean, it's fun, but it's not Twilight Imperium. Like, no, it isn't. But it means that the games are likely to be okay for people who don't play games. Your grandmother, your friend with the kids. I mean, so I was like, yeah, you know, it's got a broader market, but it's a market that doesn't know that they play games, so they're harder to get to. So I'm like, yeah, maybe I'll think about that. But what I've discovered as I've continued to kind of work on this, like, the first thing was, okay, can I make this game better for gamers? Can I make it so it's still okay for my parents, but it's more interesting for gamers? And so I've been working on that game to see if I could actually make it work for a broader audience or more for the core audience. And I've been testing that. And one of the things is I've discovered is people love the deck. The deck is really fun. It's like Penny Gems. It's like, look at this. These are crazy suits. This is a funny deck. I like owning this deck just because. For no, you know. But again, like Penny Gems, if you see the deck, you'll want the deck, but you're not going to buy the deck if you don't have an excuse. You need an excuse to buy this deck, like a game you can play with it. So I need a game. So there's a fairly good chance that what I will do after Penny Gems for Netrunner is the Finucci deck, which is tricky because there's so many cards in it that it's hard to print. But it can be done. I think it can be done and still bring it in at a price point. So that is likely. I mean, I actually posted a web page that I sent out to people on my mailing list. Here are the 15 possible projects I could kickstart. Let me know which ones appeal to you. I could be kickstarting projects constantly for the next 2 years before I'd run out of things that I could actually do.
We definitely look forward to what you put out and are more than happy to, well, obviously promote whatever you put out, sort of be boosters for you, and of course to have you on in the future to discuss any new improbable objects.
I would love to. One way or another, if you keep an eye out. Lord, whatever comes out of the improbable objects R&D department, it's likely to be strange.
That fits with the name, sir. So awesome.
Yes.
Well, man, it was awesome to have you on, without a doubt. Eric, Brian, I'm sure you concur.
That's right. You'd better. I named the company after making sure that the domain was available, and then at some point stupidly didn't actually file the damn registration. So when I went back to get, it's like, wait, oh, I don't have the improbableobjects.com. What was I thinking? Oh, and now someone took it.
Oh,
there was
squatter.
An exhibit in Chicago for a museum, and they called it and I'm like, pfft. So the domain is actually IMP, as in improbable, objobjects.com, impobj.com. Since most people find stuff with Google, I'm like, you know, that'll be fine. And it's shorter. There's a link there to the Etsy store. There's a link there to GameCrafter if you wanted to, because you could actually get the Fanucci deck now. I have it for sale on GameCrafter, although it'll be better when I have it like printed by a U.S. playing card or something. That would be what the Kickstarter campaign is for. Links to Amazon, where you can buy copies of The Primal Order. I have a few of those left, as well as the book that I did, which I have a couple hundred copies left, so you can get things from the 80s. Anyway, basically, you can go out to all the places that my stuff has landed if you start at impobj.com.
Awesome. We will obviously link to your site in this week's show notes. And, man, I just can't say it enough. You've been a great guest. This has been an amazing interview, and we really appreciate you coming on, sir.
Oh, it's fun to do these things. You know, like I said, one of the perks of the job is getting to tell stories, and that was this. So,
all right. Well, then we look forward to having you on in the future, and we will send anybody needing Kickstarter advice your way, so you have a deluge of people asking you to guide them through the Kickstarter process.
Panels and conventions! Panels and conventions!
Just kidding, man.
I might answer a question or two should it show up, though.
There you have it. He's on record.
It's happened before. I just don't promise to do it quickly.
Sure.
Correspondence is erratic depending upon what else is going on today.
Awesome, man. Well, hey, thanks for being on. Enjoy the crafting of your latest creations. We look forward to seeing the new Kickstarter, and we will talk again soon.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You bet.
Okay, guys, so what do you think? I told you, great guest, huh?
I'm actually really excited about those Kickstarter bags.
Me too. I wasn't just saying that to be flattering. Like, I really like green. When he was mentioning a new bag campaign, I was wondering if they were going to have a different color green, and Kickstarter green I happen to love.
I'm not a huge fan of Kickstarter green, but I like having, you know, because I am a fan of Kickstarter, something so perfectly themed for it. Great idea.
I also liked the fact that his perception of Kickstarter is that, yeah, of course they're a business, so they're out to make money, but they haven't lost sight of their mission in the pursuit of money, which is to bring good products out to the masses, to get projects from idea state to finished product state.
I haven't heard that from a lot of people, so I'm definitely glad to hear it from somebody, because I want to believe in Kickstarter.
What about you, Eric? What do you think?
I mean, I loved the interview. The first 45 minutes, especially when he was talking about, and I mean, that was like kind of the history of everything there when he was going into the stories of things kind of behind the scenes in the companies. I love that stuff. I love listening to behind the scenes stuff or the up and coming. It's almost like the behind the music, but I guess it would be like behind the card game in this case. But I absolutely do love those kind of stories. So I thought that was an excellent part of the interview and a lot of cool stuff to hear. I always wonder how many fans of series like Magic the Gathering actually know that stuff. I mean, I guess you'd have to be pretty diehard to dig in like that.
Yeah, I got to say, it was kind of a privilege to be talking to somebody who is that close to Ground Zero and to hear sort of from a personal perspective how the proposal was baked into the card game and so on. I thought that was awesome.
I would like to point out, though, Eric, speaking of hardcore fans, you cannot find much more of a hardcore base than the Magic the Gathering players, as evidenced by their willingness to pay $22,000 for 3 cards.
Yeah, that struck me. And the funny thing is, the most hardcore fans I know when it comes to Magic the Gathering are all on naval vessels. Apparently, the game is just massive amongst crewmen who are out to sea.
I guess you've got a limited space in which to find recreational activities, so it kind of makes sense.
Yeah, it made perfect sense to me, but I still like kind of hadn't put that together until it was explained to me, and then when I realized just how extensive it was really impressive.
What did you think of Dave's take on being an entrepreneur, launching your own products? I know we always kick around a lot of ideas we come up with. Were you encouraged, discouraged? Did you get like did you appreciate kind of a more sober, eyes open look at things?
I could see where he's coming from when he talks about how kind of the heyday of Kickstarter is gone. And something that I didn't mention earlier is one of the things that I've noticed when I go on there, and maybe this is where some of that struggle comes in, is there is a lot of copycatting. And I don't want to call it copycatting because, let's be honest, like any original idea is not truly an original idea. It's kind of what you do with other people's ideas to build on it. But there's a lot of it now. So much so that if you go on the Kickstarter website right now, literally right now, because I was on it yesterday, so I'm assuming it's still there in the top. They put like four or five articles in the big top bar. One of them is literally an article about why are there so many wallets on Kickstarter.
Yes, I read that too.
So it's like they're obviously aware, and I get his point when he says the whole point of it is to bring new cool ideas, you know, make things happen. So they're not going to say, hey, no more wallets. But I think that might be part of the issue, is that it's just so flooded and there are so many similar ideas at this point that it is hard to pick what you're going to invest in.
I'm a fan, follower, whatever you want to call it, of a website that does basically aggregate Kickstarting. They'll recommend like all the new games and everything that came out and let you decide which ones to back. And a popular joke every week on that site is how many Cards Against Humanity clones are there this week?
Yeah, and I'm not surprised by that at all. I mean, don't get me wrong, I love Cards Against Humanity. Play it all the time. I've bought every expansion. So I get it. But here's the thing. If you gave me a Cards Against Humanity clone, I would just say, hey, that's what it is. And it could be better than Cards Against Humanity. I'm still not going to invest in it because I already have Cards Against Humanity.
Yeah, it's interesting. Perhaps there's a spin on that game that might appeal to a certain subset, and maybe that's what people are trying to drive at. Like, hey, we love Cards Against Humanity. Wouldn't it be something if we could do this variation on it? And I don't know. I hate to use the term knockoffer to imply that people's efforts are highly derivative, but I don't know. I'm not sure how I feel about it. On one hand, you see a good idea and you want to put your spin on it, but does that take away from the merit of a project, I guess?
I don't think necessarily, but I think there's a lot of money grab.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with it. And I think that's where some of those kind of clone products are coming from. Not all. Like you said, some of them might be like, hey, you know, we have a great idea, just how to make this a little bit better. But again, what that does, either way, is it absolutely floods the site. And that's where the lack of a good search engine really falters.
Yeah, it sounds like the combination of the not a good categorization and system and a way to search, plus just the overall volume of things, means guys like Dave, who are coming up with sort of their own unique ideas, are drowned out for all of the just the sheer volume out there.
I mean, they basically have these projects are new and these projects are already doing phenomenal, and that's what you can limit it to,
which means if you don't take off from day one, you're kind of screwed.
So as things are on Kickstarter, you need to like burn bright and hot right away in order to keep your visibility up?
It certainly seems that way, because if those are the only two options, that you show up because you're just launching, or you show up because you're successful so far, or, you know, there's a lot of interest, then how do you get from point A to point B if there's any lull in between?
Or like Dave was saying, you have to do the offsite advertising with a Twitter campaign and a Board Game Geek campaign and a Facebook campaign.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of how he characterized the current age of Kickstarter versus the Golden Age. During the Golden Age, you started a Kickstarter. If the idea behind it itself had merit, you would succeed. But now getting the eyeballs and the dollars committed to that idea is a lot more challenging and requires a lot more good old-fashioned marketing, it sounds like. So yeah, overall, I thought this interview was great. We got some great background. We got some great personal insights and stories from the games industry. We got a really interesting peek under the covers of doing a Kickstarter campaign and crowdfunding your product. I couldn't have asked for more out of an interview. You guys concur?
I'm super happy that he shared so much future plans with us. That's awesome.
Yeah, I like that we now have breaking news. You heard it here first, folks. Nerdstravaganza. Check it out. And speaking of checking things out, you should also, of course, check out our podcast on a weekly basis. The easiest way to do that I can think of is by subscribing, either in iTunes or whatever other podcatching software you happen to use. Or if subscriptions and fat clients are not your thing, you should check out Stitcher, an amazing streaming solution where our podcast is also prominently featured.
And you should check out Facebook so you can like us, Twitter and Instagram so you can follow us, Google Plus so you can plus us, and the Nerdstravaganza HQ. It's a gaming group on Facebook.
You can find all the links from today's episode at nerdstravaganza.com or drop us a line at nerdstravaganza@gmail.com.
And until next time, dear listeners, may all of your found objects be improbable.